They decided to make a special section that would do nothing else but deceive and mystify the enemy. And so I was brought in, the only civilian ever be commissioned directly as the joint planning staff of the War Cabinet.
The D-Day landings, the British very successfully persuaded the Germans that the main landings were just a decoy.
And of course we do all the stuff in Normandy, and we managed to get complete security, complete surprise.
Well, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second hour, this week, wonderful news from across the pond as the US Supreme Court rules almost half of the state of Oklahoma is Native American property. Timed perfectly for our special look today at Genoese sailor John Cabot and his infamous 1497 genocide reconnaissance trip from Bristol to Newfoundland and back, which led to the killing of at least 20 million Native Americans in the north, and the slave trade, of course, made also the Bristol Illuminati, that is, the merchant venturers, Bristol's fortune. We ask, did the Bristol merchants already know there was a continent there? Had the Americas already been discovered, and particularly the South, colonized with a priesthood and religion put in place by the Phoenicians from what's modern Lebanon, 2,000 years before Columbus? Well, that's a big question. Also, Lebanon today, Israel's northern neighbour has been bankrupted. No more dollars, the IMF say, so they're looking at closing the country's last hospitals in 2 weeks' time. And while we're celebrating the reopening of pubs, Trump is holding his Independence Day rally. What are American values all about? And what does the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings have to say about their record on international law? China tears up the One Country, Two System treaty 27 years early, and Britain does nothing, sacrificing 7.5 million Hong Kongers to the will of President Xi. Also, the great mask divide. Medical opinion is split, though you'd never know it if you only watch the Mockingbird media. Political opinion is split. Public opinion is split over masks. Anyway, why only force people to wear them when the pandemic is virtually over? The agenda, of course, is to create an intolerable regime for everyone, unless and until you take the COVID vaccine, which there are scores of which in the pipeline. We look at a parallel divide as well, that between intelligent design and evolution. What are our kids being taught in schools? Is evolution fact or conspiracy theory? We challenge that today. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So, but joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Have you managed to resist the temptation to go to the pub all week?
Yep. Pretty much. It's not really the pub as a pub. You've got to sit in your, you know, tiny little groups. You're not allowed to communicate with other people. And I just haven't bothered with it.
This is a bit of a change for you, isn't it? I mean, you know, you've got like the Plough, which was opposite Eastern Community Centre when we were broadcasting from there. Places like that. You know, this is part of you, as I see it. You know, someone that loves actually pub chat.
It's not the same because you can't interact with people that are not in your group in the same kind of way. There's no music or singing. And also, to be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure that the government's made the right decision. So lots of people, some people did go to the pub, but the footfall was well down on a normal Saturday in July. And that's because a lot of people still not happy about going out into places where they might get infected.
So we've got an interview now to play in, and we're going to hear now the first part of a two-part interview with a guy called Matt, who's worked within the actual waste service in Bristol. And here he talks about the skip bin disaster. This is the skip bin. I don't know if you have to deal with this, Martin, over in Easter, do you, where you don't have your own bin outside your house. You have to go down the street and chuck your rubbish into a big bin.
That's the system that used to be in place where I am, but now there are individual bins for individual houses.
Okay, so what happened there?
Well, the system just changed. As you know, periodically it's reorganized, sometimes by political leaders, sometimes just because they've reorganized it. And one of the advantages of having skips, of course, we've got lots of multi-occupation properties in the road where I am, and individual bins just don't have it. There isn't enough individual bins, basically. That's the downside.
What do you prefer?
In many ways, having the skip is simple because everybody just goes and chucks it in. But of course, it leads to a situation where people are chucking everything in and it's not being sorted properly.
So well, this has been the situation.
I think the problem is, you see, if you've got in a suburb where everybody's got a detached house and a separate bins for separate things, that's all very well. But in inner city areas where many people live in, in tower blocks or in multi-occupation
houses. You're not in a tower block, though, are you?
No, I'm not. But, of course, tower blocks have their own arrangements, you know.
I'm surprised you're saying this, because the main reason that this has been done, so as far as I can see, is just to save money. You know, so we have 10 bins in the street rather than 50 or 60 bins by each house. So when the bin men come along, they just only have to empty a few giant bins. And anyway, this situation has caused absolute havoc in St Paul's, as we'll be hearing. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Matt talking about Bristol Waste and their inability to clear up the rubbish at St Paul's.
My name's Matt. I did a stint at May Gurney for Blue Arrow. That was back here in 2014, 2015. Blue Arrow are a temporary work agency sited in Bristol city centre. So the skip bins were brought in, so everybody lost their 150-litre dustbin. The skip bins were brought in, they were sited dotted up and down the roads in St Paul's, probably two or three different sites per road on the much larger ones, and two bins on each of the smaller side streets. This then led to a lot of odour, noise from the bin lids being banged and crashed constantly. And it also led to a lot of flies and unwanted odours. Very few of us actually wanted it, but we were sold it as a pilot scheme. And if we didn't feel happy with it, then just like with the residents' parking when that was brought in, if we weren't happy with it, then we could look to revoke it. But it turns out that the council's in full control and would never ever consider letting people even so much as think that others weren't enjoying the new service, and would never even contemplate revoking it. It's not just in the last few weeks, though. This has been going on for 10 years. It has come to light a lot more in the past few weeks with the temperatures going up and people becoming more vocal. But I've been monitoring the St Paul's Community Action Group since it was founded, which it was inspired by a community organiser called Jose Barco back in 2009-2010. And I've been monitoring it for a good deal of time. And there's some very proactive individuals in the area that are trying to sort this out, but they seem to be in their own little echo chamber and the council just aren't listening.
So how have we come from the stage where there was a council-run service or sitter-run service or even a May Gurney-run service which went round the city making sure all the rubbish was cleared to a situation now where the rubbish is often just left until a member of the public phones the council, emails the council, tells someone at the council, and then even then it may not get cleared up. And, of course, once that happens once or twice, people don't bother again.
So the waste contractor is contractually obliged to make proactive tickets. Those tickets should be raised by crews as they're out and about working. Now, if the crews are stressed, overworked, then their ability to do that proactive work goes by the by, I'm afraid, because the targets are what the targets are. So Supermashreek on the corner of Ashley Road, the loading bay doors open directly onto one of the MRC and skip bin sites on the corner of Ashley Road and Drummond Road. Quite often the bins there are overflowing and the side waste builds up. Rotting food spills from the bags and rats and foxes are often seen eating from there. That's at the loading bay doors for our local community shop. It's really quite disgusting on some days.
Has anything been done about that?
No. It's been questioned frequently on the St. Paul's Community Action Group. So, Supermash Week on the corner of Ashley Road. The loading bay doors open directly onto one of the MRC and skip bin sites on the corner of Ashley Road and Drummond Road. Quite often the bins there are overflowing and the side waste builds up. Food, rotting food, spills from the bags, and rats and foxes are often seen eating from there. That's at the loading bay doors for our local community shop. It's really quite disgusting on some days.
Has anything been done about that?
Nope. It's been questioned frequently on the St. Paul's Community Action Group. I see one individual has been raising the profile of that corner quite a lot recently, but we're still seeing fly tipping occurring, and it's taking quite a while to clear. I believe it was posted on Monday that there was a fly tip there, and it wasn't cleared till the Friday.
This is a basic fundamental service we all pay for in our council tax, but we've seen a slow slide. We even had the Mayor, Marvin Rees, saying that he wanted people to go out and pick up their own rubbish on their streets a few years ago.
I would hazard against doing that because individuals are not insured where the waste management company is. So to have residents go out and pick through potentially dangerous waste would, especially if it was sanctioned by the council, either worded verbally or on paper, may leave the council open to litigation.
So that is Matt, who used to work at May Gurney, Martin. Quite an interesting story, really. Two sides to it. The first is really this whole business of enormous amounts of rubbish just swirling around the streets in St. Paul's, not being collected. And one of the most important things that he talked about there is these big skip bins being left right next to basically corner shops where everyone gets their food. So you've got rats, you've got rotting, stinking rubbish all piling up right next to places where food is going into or out of our small, where we get our food from.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting to hear a sort of insider's account of waste collection in Bristol. Obviously, there are you know, specific questions about whether big bins should be used or individual bins and so on. And of course, the underlying thing which comes to my mind when we're talking about all of this is that Bristol City Council, along with most local authorities, is rapidly going bust as a result of what's been happening.
But, I mean, really, the underlying story, is really one of privatisation.
Sorry?
The underlying story really is one of privatisation.
Well, privatisation in the first place, yes. I mean, bin collection used to be a municipal function. And therefore, you know, the lines of accountability were pretty clear. When I used to go around doing canvassing in election time, people often complain about waste collection. It's one of the main things that you get to discuss. And what the councillors often have to say is we haven't got direct control over waste collection. It's been outsourced and we can complain to May Gurney or whoever is running it. But in fact, we don't have a direct way of making the only discipline we can inflict on them is not to renew the contract. And of course, if they're only doing a one-term contract and it's not renewed, it becomes in their interest to just cut corners.
So what about general waste policy? Because I understand that there is potentially anyway a pyrolysis plant opening up in Avonmouth. Now, we know already about this incinerator, which is supposed to be burning plastic, which doesn't sound to me to be very healthy, particularly since Bristol is downwind of Avonmouth. But what about this, the future for pyrolysis? Is this something which is, you think, reasonably healthy? Is it a good thing? And what is it?
So, let's start with what it is. Pyrolysis is the conversion of plastics that are made from petrochemicals back into their petrochemical component. So, you can take a large portion of plastic, push it inside of a large microwave, and microwave it at a certain frequency with a few chemicals to extract diesel from it. So, there are plants all over Indochina, all over the East, where they convert plastics into petrochemicals. Unfortunately, the emissions from these plants have led to at least one per day, going back a few years, being shut down. They're very, very dangerous construction, performing petrochemical extraction.
What's the danger? Is it through emissions? Are these plants dangerous to work in, or what?
I certainly wouldn't want to work in one. The emissions, yes, you're quite right. Some of the chemicals that they give off are not very friendly to the human form.
But what about doing this kind of thing in Bristol?
I would severely hazard against it. As you quite rightly said, Avonmouth is downwind of Bristol city centre. We have a very dense population centre here. And the sorts of chemicals that would be coming out of a plant like that would be carcinogenic. This is where they're being really cheeky, and they've built it on a site which is directly over the back of the incinerator, and more than likely any emissions from a pyrolysis plant that's built at Avonmouth will be fed back into the 1600 degree incinerator in an attempt to refire them and turn to ash, basically, anything that could potentially be carcinogenic. Unfortunately, accidents happen.
But what you're saying is that you think there's one of these plants going to be opening soon or not?
Yes. At the end of the Hallam Road, as you meet Avonmouth to go out to the Coast Road, I believe that the site that's being built there on the right-hand side is going to be a pyrolysis plant.
Now, I mean, there are people around the world that have tried to stop incinerator plants and this sort of thing, but they're finding it almost impossible to do this, Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's big money. So you're basically converting waste into petrochemicals for general sale. So it's at one phase, they'll be marketing it to the people of Bristol as a good thing because it's recycling, it's getting all these chemicals and breaking down the plastics into something. But the end product will be diesel, which is something the whole world needs to get away from.
Interesting. I mean, you know, there's also, of course, for years and years, we've seen countries like Malaysia, etc., rejecting shiploads of plastics. But you seem to be implying here that we may be importing plastics at Avonmouth and burning them and trying to make diesel out of them. But, I mean, the downside of this, of course, is it may be bad for Bristol's health.
Very much so. Okay, so we've already got large tanker ships coming into the Avonmouth port to refuel. They're not allowed to stay in the dock because they're full of waste material. So the second they've refueled, they're pushed back out to sea. Now, certain people at the port of Bristol may find it very beneficial to themselves if those plastics could be brought aground again and then shipped half a mile to a mile up the road to be converted into petrochemicals.
Do you think they should do this or not?
I am quite upset personally that they would do this for the health and safety of the entire population of Bristol. It appears to be a mafia-style industry, and trying to break into it is nigh on impossible, let alone to get any information from being on the outside. Now, Bristol's pretty much mafia-run anyway. We have our own little cartel here, and they've got their fingers in very many pies. Trying to get public oversight on things like this, the general public generally don't care what happens to their waste after they throw it away. So unless the profile's lifted and we can demonstrate that the council are actually profiting from the material that the general public is donating to them and then having to pay on top for their council tax, especially when the waste that they're contributing is then being turned into diesel and being sold on for a massive profit. There is only one mafia in Bristol. Society of Merchant Venturers.
Actually, they are involved, aren't they, in the Bristol port you just mentioned. I think it's...
The ex-mayor, George Ferguson, stood down as a merchant venturer to be able to take up the role as mayor of Bristol. The same gentleman who sold the port of Bristol to David Ord for a peppercorn. David Ord is also a member of the Society of Merchant Venturers and a large Conservative Party donor.
The other thing he just talked about then... is this pyrolysis plant at Avonmouth. Now, we keep hearing, on this show we've been covering over the last year or so, this whole idea of incinerators, which you know, generally people around Europe and around the world have considered to be a very bad idea. So just burning waste, yes, if it's paper or something like that, but not when it's heavy metals, plastics and all sorts of toxic materials being chucked into these things and burning. And then, of course, being basically on the wind heading down to us in Bristol. So whilst we've got Extinction Rebellion successfully campaigning for less cars in the city centre, we've got a whole nother sort of toxic gas waste carcinogenic stuff heading towards us from Avonmouth. But pyrolysis these plants, Martin, in even places like India, etc., have been being closed down, and yet they're opening them here in Bristol. It seems that they're, you know, trying to wait until the Bristol people start dying and realize where the toxicity is coming from before that plant gets shut down. It's a pretty cynical exercise.
Well, as you said, I mean, the waste industry is heavily, you know, it's heavily criminalized in certain parts of the world. In Italy, you know, companies get rid of waste by telling the mafia to go and take it away and put it somewhere that nobody, not taking account of health and safety issues.
Well, that's right. They get paid extra, don't they? They get paid a lot of money to dispose of very toxic waste and then just go and either dump it in the ground or in the sea.
It's a major issue in that country and has been for years. At this point, I'd like to remind you of Julian Parry, the entrepreneur stroke inventor who's dead now. He used to live in Weston-super-Mare, because he was pushing the idea of burning waste, but within sealed containers, which means that nothing escapes.
Oh, that's right. This is within an autoclave, wasn't it?
An autoclave, yeah. And of course, as you know, he went around the world talking to various governments and city authorities about adopting his invention. And I don't know what happened with that, but I mean, he made the point that if his autoclaves were used, you wouldn't have to recycle, and you can actually generate electricity from what you're doing. And you know, we need to rethink waste in a general way anyway. You know, we allow private companies to carry on producing packaging made of all sorts of noxious material. And then it's the society's responsibility to get rid of the mess. Future archaeologists are going to get very bored with finding our polystyrene burger wrappers.
So, yeah, the Bulgarian Minister of Waste, Mr. Zivkov, Krasimir Zivkov, and five others were recently arrested in Romania for racketeering, basically taking waste from all parts of the world, and I imagine being paid for it, or maybe it was just favours done, you know, a bit of leverage, because you've done us a favour, we'll do you a favour, that sort of thing, including waste from Britain, Martin, illegally.
Yeah, well, I mean, what tends to happen is lots of waste from relatively wealthy countries gets dumped in relatively poor countries. And Larry Summers, who used to be in the World Bank, said, well, it's the economic argument for this is impeccable, you know, because human life is worth more in rich countries, and therefore it makes sense to dump toxic waste in poor countries because it's got less economic impact. That's the sort of thinking that dogmatic neoliberal economics takes you to.
And they're hoping to make money from these pyrolysis plants as well, selling the diesel. So we die of cancer, but they make money out of it.
Well, as we all know, unless industries are regulated with the public interest in mind, then inevitably those who want to make profits are going to make short-term profits for themselves without taking into account the what economists call externalities of their behaviour.
I mean, to be fair to them, they would say, well, it's all safe.
It's all safe? Well, we know it's not. I mean, waste is a fundamental problem, isn't it, in any society, including human waste. That's why we have sewers and so on. And, you know, the pandemic has also brought home how interdependent human societies are. The idea that you can have individual solutions for problems which are collective is just being shown. And it was obviously logically not the case anyway. But, I mean, we're now living in a situation where the collective good is being compromised by private greed.
Well, not just compromised, trashed. And one of the people doing it is David Orr down at Bristol Port, the Merchant Venturer, he mentioned there. And there is he was the guy that was one of the main people who stopped the barrage in the Avon Gorge. I don't know if it was going to actually be in the gorge. I think it was going to be further down in the cut in the centre of Bristol. We have one of the biggest tidal ranges anywhere in the world. The other one, I think, is over in Newfoundland, which I always think is an interesting coincidence that that's where John Cabot sailed from one port, which was the biggest tidal range, to the other port, which was the biggest tidal range in the world. So an enormous amount of energy could be, electricity could be generated from that. And at Prime Minister's Questions this week, this whole idea of tidal power, which seems to be being sat on, and maybe before we hear the clip, Martin, why is it that the nuclear power station at Hinkley, which is costing an absolute fortune, is going ahead, and the electricity from it is going to be 3 or 4 or 5 times the price of, say, the tidal energy that could be being invested in with that money?
Well, you'd have to ask the government that, because that successive governments have decided that they want to subsidise nuclear power. I suppose the rationale for that is that it's it gives you security of supply. But of course, it may well be that it won't be completed. Don't forget that there's all sorts of dominoes to fall as the economic crisis.
It's not secure. This is the trouble. Is just one tiny little safety check can mean an entire nuclear power station is shut down, as they've seen in France. They had recently half their nuclear power stations shut down when they discovered cracks in some of the reactor pressure vessels, for example. So I'm just absolutely at a loss to understand why the nuclear is going ahead and tidal barrages and tidal energy isn't. But one of the reasons, obviously, is the merchant venturer David Ord down at Avonmouth, who's connected with the pyrolysis stuff there, apparently. Anyway, let's have a listen to that clip now from Prime Minister's Questions this week, which is about the Cumbria barrage.
Simon Felt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's been said, I hope not uncharitably, that my right honourable friends never met a bridge that you want to build. Off the Cumbrian coast, we've got an opportunity to steal a march with a tidal barrage which would supply 5% of the UK's energy needs in a green, sustainable way. It would leave a legacy of jobs in Copeland, Barrow-in-Furness and Workington and leave 7,000 jobs. It would allow us to connect communities that have got a terrible transport network at the moment with a shiny new bridge, and it would allow us to build our way into a green revolution. Would the Prime Minister agree to meet with me and my Cumbrian colleagues to explore this deal further?
Well, I'm very grateful to my honourable friend for bringing that attractive idea to my attention. I know that several projects are being considered along the Cumbrian coast, and I'd advise him first to get in touch with my right honourable friend, Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, to see what he could do to take it forward, and I will give what support I can.
So basically, no, Boris is saying there, certainly for the time being. We hear all this talk about green stuff, Martin, but they're not walking the walk, are they?
Well, I mean, you know, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So we hear, Bristol is a green city with the worst traffic pollution in the southwest. It's good that we talk about these things, but the problems will require action. And I come back to what I'm saying earlier. The economic crisis is gathering pace and a lot of projects are going to fail because they simply won't have funding.
Can I just say one thing about the pollution in the city, Martin? And that is, I've read some reports recently saying that because we've got a prevailing westerly wind, which comes from the west, that means that all of the industry in South Wales basically ends up coming over Bristol. It's just the west wind blows it across. And also we've got the confluence of these two major motorways, the M5 and the M4, right next to Bristol. So, you know, it does seem as if it's not just us here in Bristol that's caused this, that it might be something which is just part of our geography.
Well, if you look at the geography of all major British cities, the East End is the rough end. Yeah. And that's because that's where all the wind blew all the crap. And that's where the poor people tended to live.
Anyway,
and that's
got a
true,
special
that's true of most cities.
Clip for you now from Steve Baker. He's from the Conservative Party. He was a former, I think, Brexit minister for a while. But the Northern Ireland backstop, we haven't heard a lot about that recently, but he brought up the modern equivalent of the backstop, which is this whole idea that actually there will be a border
on the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and England at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Steve Baker. Mr. Speaker, to avoid drama later, we need to complete the process of getting Brexit done in the next few months. So will my right honourable friend, therefore, please confirm for the benefit of everyone listening that nothing in the Northern Ireland Protocol will be allowed to stop the United Kingdom charging our own tariffs for the whole United Kingdom from the 1st of January 2021?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, not a sausage, not a jot, not a tittle of the Northern Irish Protocol will provide any such impediment to the unfettered access of goods and services between all parts of the UK.
Do you believe him, Martin?
Well, they're blustering, basically. There's got to be a border in the Irish Sea. That's already been agreed. And of course, what Liz Truss's leaked letter showed this week is that they've not even sorted out what they're going to do at any of the borders, really. And of course, what will have to happen if they can't separate goods which are going from Britain to Northern Ireland, which are going to be sold in Northern Ireland, which won't be subject to tariffs, and those that are going to go on to be sold in the Republic, which will be. And therefore, all of them will have to be charged a tariff, and then those people who sell the goods in Northern Ireland will get a rebate. All of this system needs to be up and running. And of course, the other thing that's in Liz Truss's letter is that they're saying that they're not going to have tariffs for goods coming in from the EU for the first 6 months. They're going to phase it in. But of course, that's against WTO rules. Other countries could easily say, hang on a minute, you've got to give us the same most favoured nation status as anybody else if you're working on the WTO rules. Liam Fox is being put forward to be head of the WTO, but of course Trump hasn't appointed anybody to be the lead person on the disputes panel because the Americans are getting rid of the WTO. So what's going to happen as we go towards no deal Brexit on December the 31st, which looks like what it's going to be, is that there will be massive changes for British business. They've already been knocked in the teeth by COVID. They're going to have to fill in loads and loads more paperwork, online, etc., to do the stuff that they do now. And I confidently predict there will be a very severe economic shock. And then, of course, that's going to be wake-up time.
I mean, that's probably why we've seen these emergency measures worth an estimated £133 billion. Pounds, that's $164 billion since the beginning of the crisis. There's lots and lots of money being injected in, and that's Rishi Sunak, Martin.
Yes, I mean, obviously, to some extent, he's done the right thing, which is just say, right, well, we're just going to have to support the economy. The railways, for example, have been nationalised. All that fuss about whether Jeremy Corbyn could afford to rationalise the railways and whether we should nationalise the railways, even if people wanted to do it, could we do it? We've done it. And the first bus basically nationalised. The problem what we've got now is we're dishing money out, public money, but we're not getting any control. We're
just it's almost like what's happening now to keep them functioning. It's like what's happening now is exactly what happened in 2008. So the money is going there for public ownership, but there's no actual control going with it.
No, and of course that's a real problem for a conservative government with a free market philosophy, is that they've ended up running the whole economy. And this would, of course, been the case if Labour had won the election. But of course, they had a philosophy of intervening in the economy anyway. So that would have been, that would have been in line with what they wanted to do.
Another thing is, and one of the really important things is that the big auditing firms keep being found to be getting things wrong. We were discussing how Deloitte's a very important involvement in the UK's coronavirus reaction, which I found shocking since they've been fined so many times for lying. But anyway, we also hear this week, Martin, Britain's big four auditors have just 3 months to outline how they will break up their businesses after a string of scandals. Now, we've covered this over the years several times, whether it's the Monopolies and Mergers Commission, Competition and Prices people, whatever, saying that the big four auditors have got to stop the monopoly that they've got or the oligopoly that they've got. But nothing really happens, does it?
Well, one of the fundamental problems is that companies pay to be audited. So they are paying the pipers. So the auditors generally say what the companies want them to say. If they want the business, they've got to say what the companies want.
The other thing is, with this particular investigative,
but then they wouldn't get the job.
With this industry, the auditors audit also auditing each other, which is really shocking. So an auditor that is known to be not trustworthy auditing another auditor that's also known to be not trustworthy. But I find it fascinating that these people have got so much money, KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers and the rest of them, and the government feels that they're the only businesses in the country that have got enough cash to actually do things at short notice and get on and do what governments need to do. But they're not really allowing the departments to do it themselves.
Well, I mean, I would argue that if you're going to have auditors, they should just be independent, possibly run by the government. This is the private sector fallacy, isn't it?
Why have auditors got even been given a role in the testing for coronavirus?
Because what's happened is these consolidated companies, they don't just do a particular thing. I mean, the famous story of Chris Grayling giving a contract for ferries after no deal Brexit to a company that had no ferries. So and there's loads and loads of private sector companies out there. There's a brilliant article by Craig Murray this week about friends of the government being given contracts without any tendering process. I mean, basically, this is a crony capitalist regime. They could have used GP surgeries and so on to do the test and trace to do with the pandemic, but instead they gave it to private companies with personal links to ministers. And you saw the same thing with the Desmond's property development.
And the same thing exactly with Marvin Rees and Millennium Square in Bristol, and also with Temple Island in Bristol. These deals done in secret with developers, between the developers and the mayor.
Yeah, I mean, it's inevitably going to be a tension between what is best for the society at large and what is best for private interests who've got their snouts in the trough. And, it's not just the central government that is potentially at fault here, but I think the philosophy and the underlying practice of the kind of people that are running this Conservative government is very much to line the pockets of their mates. And that's what they're doing.
One of the biggest financial firms in the country is Hargreaves Lansdown. We had a little scrape with them, Martin, didn't we, because of the broadcast we did explaining that the former fraud squad officer, Rowan Bosworth Davis, had interviewed, Stephen Hargreaves, Peter Hargreaves, under caution three times for fraud, because what he said was that he'd been taking clients' money and then using his insider knowledge to invest it. And when they asked for their share certificates, they couldn't get their share certificates because the money had been taken and used elsewhere. Only when they started getting shirty would they ever get their share certificates, and that the money would be put into the shares that they told it had been. So that, that's the Hargreaves Lansdown. They are our local people. But I noticed this week that Welcome revamp, but Hargreaves Lansdown's shortlist still has faults. The wealth manager's move is long overdue, coming more than a year after it was deservedly criticised for labelling investment fund Woodford Equity Income a best buy, right up until the day it crashed and was suspended. So there's literally tens of thousands of people, Martin, that have lost their savings through this Woodford Equity Income Fund. And Hargreaves Lansdown have only really just acted to suspend the chap who was responsible for that fund, ultimately.
Well, we all know that there's an awful lot of people out there who haven't got any underpants on when the tide goes out. I can't keep coming back to this. The economic crisis is just getting going. And when it gets going, you're going to have chains of bankruptcy running through the system.
We heard about the mafia just now in waste, but this sounds like in the financial industries. And the article goes on, the revamp is not without its faults. Eyebrows will be raised at the continued involvement of Mark Dampier in the overseeing of the so-called wealth shortlist. Well, how interesting that some of the people have gone who were involved in that fund, but others have been retained, those people who were solidly recommending Hargreaves Lansdown. Anyway, look, let's move on and have a look at the COVID crisis and Prime Minister's questions this week, the issue of care homes and Boris Johnson's criticism of them. Although I think, you know, we've got to be careful here to see whether he's having a go at the managers of the care homes or the workers, came up at Prime Minister's questions.
Keir Starmer.
By refusing to apologise, the Prime Minister rubs salt into the wounds of the very people that he stood at his front door and clapped. The Prime Minister and the Health Secretary must be the only people left in the country who think that they put a protective ring around care homes. Those on the front line know that that wasn't the case. I quote one care home manager from ITN News yesterday. She said this, "I'm absolutely livid at the fact that he says we didn't follow the procedures, because the care assistants, the nurses, everyone in the care home have worked so hard. And then he's got the audacity to blame us." Her words. What would the Prime Minister like to say to that care home manager?
What I would like to say to the lady in question, and indeed to every care home worker in the country, is that this government appreciates the incredible work that they have done. We thank them for the incredible work they have done. And let me say further that we will invest in our care homes and we will reform the care home sector. And I hope, by the way, Mr. Speaker, that we'll do it on the basis of cross-party consensus and get a lasting solution to the problems in our care homes and the difficulties many people face in funding the cost of their old age. That's what we want to do. That's what this government is pledged to do after 30 years of inaction, and I hope that he will join us in doing it.
Well, shilly-shallying answer there, all right. And actually, the fact of the matter was, Martin, that the hospitals were pushing patients out of hospital. They wanted to clear the hospitals, quite understandably, into care homes. And yet the care homes are the ones that are being criticised.
Well, they didn't test the people before they went. If they'd known who was, you know, basically, if somebody's got COVID, you don't want to send them off into a care home, which is an environment where you're going to spread it. And they clearly made an absolute blunder there. And, of course, the attempt to try and blame the care sector for the failures of the government is pretty transparent, and you've got Keir Starmer there holding them to account for it. Underlying all of this, the Prime Minister mentioned 30 years of drift in this sector. That's because it was privatised by the Thatcher government in the 1980s. Local authorities used to run all of this, and it was all basically run properly. And then the private sector were brought in, and you've got the nonsense that we've now got, which has led directly to the deaths of thousands and tens of thousands of people, which were probably preventable. There's going to have to be an inquiry into all of this. And if the pandemic's over, as you suggested earlier, then it should happen now. I don't think it is over, but we're going to have an inquiry, and maybe heads will have to roll. Because it's been pretty incompetent from the get-go, hasn't it?
Well, there are certain people. I don't know if you were in Serbia, Martin, whether you'd be down in Belgrade. Is it at the capital?
I've not actually been to Serbia. No, I used to go to Bosnia a lot, but not Serbia.
Anyway, there, over the last few days, they've had riots with Parliament being stormed by people who are simply not going to accept having a lockdown, another lockdown there. They've just had an election, I understand, and then the first policy apparently after the election was, okay, we're going to have a lockdown, even though before the election they were saying, oh, we're not going to. But anyhow, let's just have a listen now to what was going on at the Serbian parliament the other day. So they've been, increasing around the world. There's been movements since the start of the lockdown against it, Martin. Can you understand why people are thinking, actually, particularly young people who aren't at risk from this, that they don't want to do lockdowns, they don't want to do the masks, they don't want to do all these measures? It's an infringement of their civil liberties.
Well, in Serbia, you may have other factors at play because, you know, the colour revolutions were pioneered in Serbia in the 1990s by Otpor, and that's what the current government is saying, that this is politically motivated. And in any case, if you're protesting peacefully against something, you don't try and storm the parliament building and smash the place up. I think there's an issue for demonstrators all over the world here demonstrators have got to be peaceful, and the police have got to police with consent and without.
They're angry. They felt betrayed because before the election, they were saying, "Oh, we've done very well here in Serbia." And as soon as the new government is in, it says, "Oh, okay, sorry guys, we're going to have to do a lockdown now."
Yeah, well, I mean, there's going to be tension about this all over the world because of the incompatibility of the goals of which governments have got, you know, and also, of course, if you're going to carry people, you've got to be consistent in your messaging, and you've got to stick to what you say you're going to do and explain why you're doing it.
One of the things that definitely hasn't been consistent is the idea of having these Black Lives Matter protests and the tearing down of the Colston statue. I mean, it does seem strange that you've got, you know, sort of certain groups seem to almost have a pass where they can just ignore the lockdown, whereas others don't. I was looking at recently, I put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, to quite an interesting story here about George Soros and his funding of Black Lives Matter through something called the Democracy Alliance. They also, by the way, include a woman called Leah Hunt Hendricks, who is the granddaughter of Texas oil tycoon H.L. Hunt, who is one of the conspirators of the JFK assassination. It seems here there's a sort of elite in the U.S. that has decided that it's going to just control everything. And, of course, she's white, and yet there she is, one of the leading people in Black Lives Matter.
Look, the Black Lives Matter movement, or whatever it is a large and complex structure. It's not a structure. You've got lots of people who are just picking it up because they've picked it up on social media.
Well, I mean, she's from the Democracy Alliance, which is funding it.
And there's funding for politics. Sheldon Adelson, who owns most of the casinos in Macau and in Nevada, is a very big fund. He's the biggest funder of U.S. politics by far. He's the biggest funder, and funds. Look,
we're just
people.
Talking about H.L. Hunt at the moment, actually. Yeah, with one of the JFK conspirators. I'm just trying to focus on this particular strand of big oil funding these political movements. H.L. Hunt also funded the Nation of Islam, despite his ties to the Ku Klux Klan and the John Birch Society. So it seems that there are factors behind the scene, almost like a third force with lots of money behind the scene, who quite like funding both sides in these civil society struggles.
Yes, and basically what they want to do is they're basically hedge betting. They're trying to make sure that whoever wins, they win. And in any case, the intelligence services want, as in Operation Gladio, they want to, there are some left-wing terrorists and some right-wing terrorists. The same thing happened in Turkey in the run-up to the military coup in 1980. But the concentration on Soros is an open funder of liberal causes, including very anti-Russian causes, for example. So he's got his agenda. But what can you do when politicians need money to carry out politics? And then the people with money say, well, we've got money, but we've got an agenda. Now, the only way you break out of that is you fund your political party through trade union contributions, for example, or you have a revolutionary struggle where you pay revolutionary taxes.
Hang on. There's a much, much, much better way. And that is which many democracies in Europe do, is you get money for a political party, not depending on how many seats you win, but how many votes you get.
That's right. It's not seats anyway. It's votes. I mean, that's what they do in Scandinavia. It's still not entirely, I mean, wealthy people still have more of a voice than poorer people, but it levels the playing field. The US, it's absurd to run for any kind of office. You have to have loads of money, or you have to have loads of money behind you. And of course, that's the way this country's going too.
And I mean, for example, David Ord.
People with the money can get what they want.
We were talking about him earlier on, David Ord at Bristol Port, involved in this Avonmouth, the dodgy deals with George Ferguson, the stopping of the Avon barrage. Well, of course, he's a major Conservative Party funder.
Well, that's right. And some of these people fund Conservative politics because they are Conservative. And some of them fund it because they're going to get kickbacks, effectively. That's what it's about. And if anybody thinks that anything else is going on, I have a suspension bridge to sell them.
Martin, look, let's get back to COVID. And, you know, way back in February, you and I sat in that studio before we were removed by the managing editor.
from BCFM's FM channel. And we discussed a story from Zero Hedge, which was from, I don't know if you remember, from some Indian virologists at the Virology Institute. This is when the COVID-19 didn't exist. It was just the virus, and it was in Wuhan, and no one really knew anything about it. But these virology students in New Delhi had done a report, literally a day-long or day-and-a-half brainstorm of all the best virologists in Delhi. And they came out with this report, and they said, well, we haven't peer-reviewed this. Well, this has not been peer-reviewed, but here's our report anyway. And we're putting it out there because we think it's so important that you see this, that it appears that this virus, because the Chinese had just released the genome, it appears this virus has two deliberate protein insertions on it. One is the AIDS protein, and another one is the SARS protein. And it looks to us as if this is unlikely to have been able to occur naturally. Now, that story that led to, some would argue, although Twitter didn't say that it was particularly that story, but a day and a half later, Zero Hedge was suspended from Twitter, and they've only just been, like 2 weeks ago, got their Twitter account back. So I would suggest everybody subscribes to Zero Hedge because they've got some fascinating information. And the reason I say that is because just this week on the BBC World Service, there's a report by Professor Adrian Hayday from King's College, and he's also from the Francis Crick Institute, who's saying, actually, look at this COVID-19, as we now call it. It seems to have the characteristics of AIDS, which was exactly what those Indian virologists were saying back in the first week of February on our show via us. So let's have a listen to him now.
At the beginning of the pandemic, it looked like COVID-19 was a respiratory illness. Now we know it can also affect other organs, and it appears it can also short-circuit the immune system, working in a way that's similar to HIV. I've been speaking to Dr. Adrian Hayday, a group leader at the Francis Crick Institute and Professor of Immunobiology at King's College London.
The surprising thing is that there are huge losses of T cells, which are lymphocytes, which are extremely important in protecting us against pathogens, that we see in COVID-19 that are reminiscent to some extent in HIV. And what's extraordinary is that HIV achieves this by directly infecting the T cells and dysregulating or reorganizing the T-cell compartment, whereas there's no evidence that the COVID virus does this. It seems to do it by some as yet unknown mechanism indirectly. And you see in post-mortem analyses necrotic areas where you would normally have T-cells, very similar to what you used to see on AIDS patient post-mortems.
Given what you've said, what are the implications then for not just treatments, but long-term recuperation, let alone vaccines?
The good news is that the immune system is usually incredibly good at bouncing back. So while there will, of course, be all sorts of appropriate downstream studies of individuals who've been through COVID-19 disease and have required hospitalization, I don't think there's any reason at this point to be concerned of long-term consequences. In the shorter term, we definitely are in a situation where a whole set of individuals, that is, these individuals who seem to require hospitalization, do seem to have been disabled for one part of their protective response. So our response in turn to that comes in multiple ways. One is to boost T cell responses. And the other is, of course, as we go forward and think about improving vaccine designs, making sure that we consider that these individuals may be needing more support for their T cell compartment.
Do you know enough now to say that some of the treatments will involve the kind of antiretroviral drugs that are successful to treat HIV patients?
Antiretrovirals used in HIV will have their equivalents for coronavirus. The basic research that has gone into detailed understanding of what people's immune systems look like in this disease is moving us from a place where we had general ideas to now where we've got some very specific ideas, and that always helps you in the design of improved treatment. So I'm very optimistic that this disease will get more manageable, and that's critical to reducing the global threat that the virus poses.
Optimistic news from Dr. Adrian Hayday, group leader at the Francis Crick Institute and a professor at King's College, London.
Well, how fascinating. And I couldn't see that reported anywhere else apart from that little item on the World Service, Martin. But you mentioned the cytokine storm, didn't you, when I was over in New Zealand? It looks as if this is absolutely key to understanding what the COVID-19 is really all about, and that quite a lot of hospitals, even though we're not medically trained, you know, doctors basically do what they're told. If they're told it's pneumonia they've got to treat, they'll treat pneumonia. But it doesn't look as if this really was pneumonia at all.
Well, there's all sorts of things about this virus that we still don't understand. It's not a flu. We don't know what it is. The question of whether it's a bioweapon is still open. And, of course, the Murdoch press and elements within the security services have been pushing the idea that it is a bioweapon that's leaked from the Wuhan laboratory, which in fact is not a weapons laboratory. It's a research laboratory. Which gets
lots
of money from
DARPA. They never are.
Well, no, and of course, no. Well, our ones are. They're there for, you know, Poulton Down is there to research
let's cut to the chase here, because it looks to me as if the Americans or somebody has tried to pin this on the Chinese as a Chinese virus, and it hasn't quite worked.
Well, it hasn't quite worked for a number of reasons. Also, of course, it may not have started in Wuhan. The people have found evidence of it being in Barcelona last February. So there's still lots and lots of questions out there. And I don't think we can all presume that we've got the answers. It may be a biowarfare attack, and that may explain why it is so elusive, this virus. Yeah, it's got some very interesting features.
Well, it's elusive because there's lots and lots of lies and disinformation, and there's an enormous amount of censorship going on.
Well, there is, but there's a massive amount of information, but you've got to sort your way through it.
Well, but that's not what we as members of the public are supposed to do. Journalists are supposed to do that for us, and yet they haven't been doing it, and they haven't been representing a spectrum of opinion. For example, as I said, that guy from the Francis Crick Institute, Professor Adrian Hayday, hasn't been reported anywhere, so far as I can see, even though what he's saying is extremely important and it would be a great use to people who are suffering from this, their relatives are, or particularly the medical profession around the world.
Well, he was being interviewed on the BBC there, so he can't say that he didn't
get
a platform.
I'm saying that was the only place. So there's nobody else has picked up on this as a journalist.
Well, nobody picked up on there is it a bioweapon? If it's got bits of AIDS tacked into it, that's what the suggestion was when the Indian researchers came out with their stuff. Now, let's just run through the possibilities logically. It isn't a bioweapon. It is one of the logical. It's just a natural phenomenon, which, of course, is causing all kinds of problems. It is a bioweapon, and it was released accidentally by the Chinese. Of course, what's being suggested by Pompeo and others, that it's been deliberately released by the Chinese. But I can't see that that makes any sense, because they wouldn't release it on themselves. They'd release it in the United States, wouldn't they? The third possibility is it's been released by accident by the Americans from Fort Detrick, which was closed for several months in the middle of last year for some undisclosed problem, which may have been the leakage of this. And they've all been working on bat coronaviruses, all of these laboratories. And the fourth possibility is a deliberate attack on the Chinese by the Americans or the deep state. And they're perfectly happy to have it flow back over the US because they want to bail the banks out and they want to get rid of Trump.
I mean, Martin, let's just also take up the possibility that the enormous shock to the financial system might be designed to bankrupt the planet.
Well, the shock to the financial system, this is the interesting thing, because the financial sector started collapsing in September. And that's when the Federal Reserve went into warp drive in order to try and prevent a collapse.
It's done that a few times.
Yeah, and then in November, the Israeli Defense Forces and others were warned that a pandemic was coming out of China. How did they know? I think that's very significant. How did they know?
Well, the US warned them, didn't they?
No, the US warned the IDF, but the Chinese didn't know it was going to happen. They didn't know anything was happening till December. So look at the timelines here. And therefore, I'm not convinced. I don't know. But the suspicion has to be that this is a biowarfare attack by the same people that carried out the 9/11 attacks, the same structures in order to trash the Chinese economy just as it was getting into its stride.
Okay, so who carried
also
out the
allowing
9/11
the possibility
who
for
carried out the
9/11
attacks?
Of the banking
who system. Who carried out the 9/11 attacks?
Well, that's obviously the US security forces working with Israeli intelligence. I mean, I think that Russian general staff and the Chinese general staff will know that. And of course, knowing that, they are very suspicious when things like this happen, especially in China, where you've had a massive swine flu epidemic, swine fever, killing off their pig herd. Then they kill off their chickens, and then suddenly this comes along. Just at the moment when they're in a trade war with the US.
Okay,
the
so
US is quite capable of doing underhand things.
Well, it might not necessarily be the US authorities, might it? It might be the CIA, intelligence services, people within the CIA, even corporate interests, arms industry, the arms industry.
Yeah, we're talking about the deep state here. The deep state needs enemies, there's something called the Thucydides trap. Which is a book written not long ago, and it's about how rising powers like China always come into conflict with existing powers like the US. Well, and they compared it to the rivalry between Athens and Sparta. So they're talking about if we don't break the legs of the Chinese now, we're not going to get the chance. So let's go for it.
People like Pepe Escobar have been talking about hybrid warfare. But look, anyway, let's have a listen now to the real victims of the deep state, if this is the case. And that is young people, because that came up at Prime Minister's Questions, the way that the whole COVID hysteria and pandemic is affecting our youngsters.
Sir Geoffrey Clifton-Brown.
Mr. Speaker, the coronavirus has hit young people in work and those about to enter the jobs market particularly hard. Would my right honourable friend therefore continue to build on his excellent package of announcements so far so that our young people have hope and encouragement for the very best prospects for the start of their working life?
Absolutely, Mr. Speaker. I thank my right honourable friend. We want young people to have the self-confidence and the experience of work to keep learning on the job and to get the jobs that they need. And if you'll wait just a few minutes, he'll be hearing rather more from my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, about that very matter.
So, yes, the youngsters, Martin, is really very bad for them in many ways. This, bad for job prospects. And, I mean, you know, for young people to get their foot on the property ladder, for example, it's going to be almost impossible.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, the relaxation of stamp duty is basically a subsidy to those who already own homes. So, I mean, a lot of what he's done, he's decided that there is a magic money tree. Hooray. But of course, the money is going to be spent in ways which are useful to the coalition of the Conservative Party. And a lot of that money is going to go into the pockets of their supporters. That's the way it works, folks. And of course, there's a real question that whether whatever expansionary measures the government adopts in this position are going to be enough to counteract the deflationary pressures that are coming down the pile. And I think quite clearly that they're not going to be enough and that there's going to be a crash. And this crash will feed on itself.
You've been saying this for a long time. It's
but it only happens once.
Surely the timing of something like that, Martin, is really down to the big powerful bankers. Because at some point they just go, well, we're not going to lend to you anymore. And everything starts like a house of cards to come down.
Well, what's happened is, bizarrely enough, as we've had the worst unemployment figures in the United States ever, the stock market has boomed because they've chucked loads of money that they're basically buying any old junk just to keep the stock market going.
Anyway, certainly the capitalism seems a little bit fragile with actually the Chinese actually looking one of the strongest countries in the world at the moment. But financially anyway. Martin, you and I know a chap called Ian R. Crane who's recently recovered to a certain extent. He's not fine yet, but he was literally given a very short time to live. And he's one of the former chairmen of the UK 9/11 Truth Campaign. Can you just say something a little bit about Ian Crane? Because you got to know him pretty well, and so did I.
Well, I mean, he was very good at organising things, getting people together to question about 9/11 and other things. And he was, he managed to put together events which people were prepared to pay to come to, which you know, you say, why do you pay, have people pay? Well, if you pay, get people to pay, then you can have, you know, more speakers, and you can have a better quality of event. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that Ian agrees with. I wasn't that convinced about the fake alien invasion around the 2012 Olympics, which never seemed to appear. But I think he's been a important person in terms of opening people's minds to questions that they wouldn't otherwise think. That's why a lot of his stuff was called alternative view.
The establishment would argue, certainly the establishment media, that the guy's an extremely dangerous conspiracy theorist and everything he says should be kept off the airwaves.
Well, I think the fact is some of the things he helped to organise David Ray Griffin's speech in London years ago about 9/11. But just because you think 9/11 was an inside job, which is what the Russian general staff think, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's being done by aliens or anything.
Ian was also from the energy industry, and it is fascinating. I mean, we were talking earlier about nuclear power and about the idea of tidal power. And these sorts of choices, but actually it's been an incredibly contested area, energy, hasn't it? And particularly to do with the post-Second World War policy about oil, you know, making sure that the world's oil fields are under US control, if at all possible, in case there's another war, in which case they will have access to oil and the enemy hopefully wouldn't. But also, you know, that is partly also linked, Martin, isn't it, to the coal strikes in Britain. In the 1970s and 1980s, and the massive one in the 1980s, which finally put an end to the coal industry. Why is it energy seems to be such an important industry that when we vote, we don't get any say? The energy industry seems to be more deciding what governments do than we do.
Well, I mean, you're simplifying that because it's very complicated, isn't it? Energy is a necessary function of life. What you didn't mention there, of course, is the petrodollar system. After 1973 and the oil price hike by OPEC, Saudi Arabia agreed to accept only dollars for oil. And that means that everybody has to have oil. Even the small countries with that big industry, they need oil for just, you know, delivering goods and so on. And everybody therefore has to have dollars. And because they have to have dollars, it allows the US to basically print dollars, which they don't have to, you know, they can use that to buy stuff with. And they use all of that to fund their hundreds of military bases around the world. So the system we've got it's like a tribute system like the Roman Empire, where everybody has to buy their oil from with dollars, and therefore they have to have dollars. Therefore the US is able to basically live for free on the back of the rest of humanity. Now, of course, the rest of humanity are getting quite fed up with this, not least the Chinese Communist Party and the Russian Federation. And at some point, this town ain't going to be big enough for the both of us, and there's going to be a showdown. We're getting closer and closer to it.
Anyway, let's have a listen now. Another big, powerful industry, of course, is the pharmaceutical industry. And let's have a listen now to Ian Crane, what he has to say. It's part of he's trying to do a fundraiser, basically, at the moment. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Amazingly, he had one of his AV talk sessions scheduled. I think it was for the end of May, beginning of June, or maybe the end of April. But obviously that couldn't happen because of the lockdown. And so, you know what? Rather than cancel it, he did the whole thing online anyway. But let's have a listen to Ian Crane now. He's rather concerned about the way that the lockdown is affecting young people, and also the way that the pharmaceutical industry has much too big a say.
It is teenagers and, you know, preteens that are feeling the pain the most. And no surprise, you know, basically they are scared on the basis that, you know, what future do they have? You know, is there a pandemic out there that's going to kill them? No, absolutely not. But is there a concerted effort by governments all around the world to destroy economies to prevent them from having any opportunity to sustain any kind of reasonable lifestyle? And the answer to that is, without any shadow of doubt, yes. And why is this happening? Primarily because we're allowing it to happening. You know, I've been making a few short forays into the town here. And, you know, it's gratifying to see that the people wearing masks are very much in the minority. And, you know, random conversations with people in the street indicates that people aren't falling for this. And the longer it goes on, people are asking more and more questions. And it's very evident that Boris is not in control. Who is in control? Well, is it Dominic Cummings? Doubtful. Is it the puppet masters of Dominic Cummings? Now we're starting to make some headway. So, you know, it's really important that people do research. And what is fantastic is that, you know, more and more and more people are digging and coming up with, you know, new insights and new documentation which reveals, you know, exactly what's occurring here. But the World Economic Forum and, you know, all the mega wealthy who are not affected by this keep referring to the Great Reset. And for them, the Great Reset is about ensuring that they mop up the last remaining bits of wealth, which is probably less than 5% of the total global wealth, but they mop it up from amongst the proletariat. And, you know, my heart goes out to people like Dr. Iqbal Adil. You know, he is a British Pakistani doctor who has been practicing medicine in the UK since 1986. But he saw through this outrage. He saw through the conspiracy and was openly speaking, you know, within his community. And, you know, as far back as late April and May, was encouraging people to join him in Parliament Square to call for the restoration of freedoms and ability to earn a reasonable livelihood. And now, you know, for his honesty, for his conviction, for his insight, he has been struck off by the GMC, the General Medical Council. And the GMC, of course, is, you know, very similar to the MHRA, the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, that front for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, so that's Ian Crane there. Martin, in a nutshell, the most important thing I suppose he's saying there really is, apart from just looking at the plight of young people, is people have lost, many, many, many people, millions of people have lost their ability to earn.
Yeah, and that's because if what would have happened if the stock market had carried on collapsing in September and they hadn't bailed it out is that the economy would have collapsed. They bailed it out because COVID gave them a cover to bail it out, but this is the last time they're going to be able to do that. And there is now another bubble developing, the biggest bubble.
Well, what are people supposed to do if they can't earn enough money to survive? Because one of the most important beneficiaries, and he said, oh, well, the rich haven't really been affected. Well, they have. They've actually done incredibly well out of it. It's a few, you know, just the big tech giants, for example, are laughing. They've pushed the high street down the tubes. Probably, you know, they've pushed the whole takeover and the death of the high street up maybe 2 or 3 years just through this. And they're doing extremely well. Big business is doing extremely well out of it. Ordinary people have been screwed.
Yeah, well, it's basically the same thing that happened in 2008. The banking system was about to collapse. Then COVID came along. Ooh, isn't this great? We've got an excuse to bail the banks out again. Now, what's happening is that the wealthy and who own assets are basically having their assets supported by the support of the state, indirectly implying the taxpayer is going to basically make them whole at the same time as everybody else is going down the drain. Now, if COVID hadn't come along, that would have happened anyway, and we would have been having a debate about why are we bailing the banks out again. Most people haven't even really realised that that's what's going on. They've been concentrating on COVID. Now, don't forget, we've been just discussing whether COVID is man-made and whether it's a bioweapon. Now, it can't all be these two things are not quite compatible. If it's a bioweapon, it's real. It kills people. It's not just something that's been made up. And I think it is a bioweapon designed to destroy the Chinese and to facilitate the last bailout of the banks. Because when it goes down, the insiders will get out. The mom and pop investors will be left holding the bag, and the basically ordinary people will lose everything. Local authorities will go bust. Your business, the business you work in will go bust. The government won't pay your pension. This is what happened in Russia.
Okay, so why is it that masks are being introduced in many countries? Sometimes the people are just ignoring it. In fact, if you go on the buses here, you'll find obviously people wear a mask as they're getting onto the bus, and as soon as they get on the bus, they take it off. People are not really up for that. But why introduce masks right at the very end? I mean, I suppose the same sort of thing could be said for care homes, that the measures in care homes seem to have been introduced right towards the end of the pandemic. We're right down now, literally, to a very, very... I mean, I'll tell you, one of the things I'll definitely do, Hector Drummond's website in the States has got some fantastic graphs just made from the NHS weekly statistics, and I'll put one up there to show you just how low the curve now is in the UK. And they seem to keep putting it on the TV, the total of people, which makes it sound more than it really is, because you know, there's a handful of people dying every day, but it doesn't sound very impressive until you add it to the total of people who've already died. Why masks as the pandemic is finishing, Martin?
Well, if you look in China, in Wuhan, they made sure everybody wore masks. In South Korea, they wore masks. In Vietnam, they wore masks. In Hong Kong, they wore masks.
I mean, is it just shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted? Well,
precisely, but if you're going to have the release on lockdown on Independence Day, July the 4th, a Saturday, chosen by Cummings, no doubt, because that's the effect that he wanted to create. It's all over now. But you've got to say, well, if we're going to have all these people going back into crowded situations, they should wear masks.
Well, now, you I don't say really that, but surely it's just a bit of a joke, isn't it? It's US Independence Day, so let's call it that.
No, they chose to open the pubs on a Saturday, July the 4th, so that you could have banner headlines in the Daily Express saying Independence Day and pictures of people toasting Boris. It's all being run by politics.
Are they toasting Trump, really? We don't celebrate 4th of July, so aren't they really toasting Trump?
Well, the point is that what's driving this isn't scientific advice. It's political manipulation.
Good point. Anyway, thanks to our guest. That's Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist. And we'll be back soon to take a weekly look around the world. We'll be right back.
So, welcome back to BCFM's politics show with the Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. That was Glowworm from 1993, lifting their cup. This week, wonderful news from across the pond as the US Supreme Court rules almost half the state of Oklahoma is Native American property. Timed perfectly for our special look this week at Genoese sailor John Cabot and his infamous 1497 genocide reconnaissance from Bristol to Newfoundland and back, which led to the killing of at least 20 million Native Americans in the north of America, and also, of course, the slave trade made the Bristol Illuminati, the merchant venturers, Bristol's fortune. We asked, did the Bristol merchants already know there was a continent there? Had the Americas already been discovered, and particularly the South, colonized with a priesthood and religion put in place by the Phoenicians from what is modern Lebanon, 2,000 years before Columbus? Well, also Lebanon today, Israel's northern neighbor, has been bankrupted. No more petrodollars for them from the IMF. They are looking at closing the country's last hospitals in 2 weeks' time. So absolute chaos coming to Lebanon, unless something's done about that. Well, that's rather convenient for their neighbours in Israel, isn't it? And while we were celebrating the reopening of pubs, Trump was holding his Independence Day rally. What are American values all about? And what does the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings? That is Agnes Callamard. What does she say about their record on international law? And China tears up the one country, two systems treaty 27 years early. Britain does nothing, sacrificing 7.5 million Hong Kongers to the will of President Xi, unless actually they may be able to come to Britain, of course. And the grey mask divide, we heard a bit about that already. Medical opinion is split. Will people be forced to wear them when the pandemic is over? The agenda, of course, is to create an intolerable regime for everyone, unless and until you take the COVID vaccine. We may look, if we get time, at a parallel divide. That's between intelligent design and evolution. What are our kids being taught in schools? Is evolution fact or conspiracy theory? So I think we should start, Martin, by looking at this extraordinary news today about the Native Americans. I mean, it hasn't really made much in the way of headlines, but when I was over in Vancouver back in February, I was amazed to find that a similar kind of settlement had been made in Vancouver a few years ago, where the courts in Canada had said, well, actually, this is Native American land. I think they call it First Peoples land or something in Vancouver. But this decision today is pretty extraordinary. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have imagined that the Supreme Court would have awarded Native Americans this land. It's ruled that about half of Oklahoma now belongs to Native Americans in a landmark case, that quashed a child rape conviction. It's involved with a different case. The justices decided 5-4 that an eastern chunk of the state, including its second biggest city, Tulsa, should be recognized as part of a massive reservation. Jikmi McGirt, who was convicted in 1997 of raping a girl, he brought the case. He cited the historical claim of the Muscogee Creek Nation to the land where the assault occurred. Thursday's decision means one of the most far-reaching cases from Native Americans before the highest court in decades. So, I mean, if you look at the map, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, it is a big chunk of Oklahoma, Martin, most of the eastern side. So that's Chickasaw, Choctaw, Seminole, Muscogee, and Cherokees.
Yeah, well, I mean, I must say I haven't looked in detail at this decision. It's an interesting decision. I don't know what the implications will
be. Well, I'll tell you what some of the implications are. Only federal prosecutors would have the power to criminally prosecute Native Americans. So that means that there's far less jurisdiction for the state government of Oklahoma. Tribe members who live within the boundaries would also be exempt from state taxes, according to Reuters. Some 1.8 million people, of whom about 15% are Native Americans, live on the land, which spans 3 million acres.
Well, if they don't have to pay any taxes, you can see why that might be attractive to the Native Americans.
Well, it's state taxes, yeah. So this may be actually partly to do with a sort of power grab by Washington from the individual state capitals.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to hear some of Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore later, I believe. And, of course, the local Oglala Sioux, who own what they don't call it Mount Rushmore. I think they call it something else. They weren't very happy about him coming in at all. They said, we don't really want you here. But he went anyway because they couldn't stop him. And, of course, you know, the whole of Mount Rushmore with the faces of famous American presidents on it, that's basically a standing insult to the Oglala Sioux. Those are the Black Hills. You know, those are their sacred hills. And the American state chose to memorialize itself there.
Quite a lot of the American state does tend to sort of rub the Native Americans' noses in it, doesn't it? And, you know, of course, we in Bristol bear some responsibility as modern Bristolians for that whole episode. Another one is the Thanksgiving. I was amazed to find that it's actually the anniversary of a horrific massacre of Pequot Indians in New England. And that is celebrated every year as Thanksgiving, even though actually the original event was a massacre of Pequot Indians. They managed to infiltrate their camp, tricked their leaders, and did a midnight massacre and then burnt the whole place to the ground. And that's Thanksgiving.
Well, I think the official story of Thanksgiving, it was to do with the Indians being welcoming to the settlers and how they all got along. And of course, in a way, that's totally rubbish. I mean, and you mentioned the millions that died.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what, Martin, just to clear that up, what I'll do is I'll put, because it wasn't welcoming, certainly not for the Pequot Indians. I think it's Mashnantucket, it was somewhere like that. And I'll put a link up on our show page to the original events of the English people who were going over there. And maybe connected with the merchant venturers in Bristol, what they did is they basically just burnt this town to the ground. They infiltrated a village, got the trust of people over trade, and then they tricked them. And so I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But carry on, I was interrupting you there.
I was going to say, the obviously there was lots of destructive, deliberate murder of Native Americans. But, of course, one of the other major factors was that they had no immunity to new old world diseases. And that was probably one of the biggest die-offs in history, sadly.
An analysis by the Atlantic magazine of Oklahoma Department of Corrections found that 1,887 Native Americans were in prison as of the end of 2019 for offences committed within the boundaries of the tribal territory, but only around about 1 in 10 of those cases would qualify for a new federal trial, according to the research. So it's interesting. It doesn't really seem to be affecting much, other than they're saying that Washington is in charge of this land and things that happen here, not Oklahoma City.
Well, I mean, as you know, the history of this is very convoluted and extremely sad. I mean, I remember reading the book Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee in the 1970s about the way in which Native Americans have been treated. And of course, it's not just in the United States. Indigenous people all over the world are under threat. In the Amazon in particular, there's huge problems. And, not much changes, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, let's have a listen now to Donald Trump then in his Independence Day speech. A celebration at Mount Rushmore.
All men are created equal. These immortal words set in motion the unstoppable march of freedom. Our founders boldly declared that we are all endowed with the same divine rights given us by our Creator in heaven. And that which God has given us, we will allow no one ever to take away, ever. In 1776 represented the culmination of thousands of years of Western civilization and the triumph of not only spirit, but of wisdom, philosophy, and reason. And yet, as we meet here tonight, there is a growing danger that threatens every blessing our ancestors fought so hard for, struggled, they bled to secure. Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. Angry mobs are trying to tear down statues of our founders, deface our most sacred memorials, and unleash a wave of violent crime in our cities. Many of these people have no idea why they are doing this, but some know exactly what they are doing. They think the American people are weak and soft and submissive. But no, the American people are strong and proud, and they will not allow our country and all of its values, history, and culture to be taken from them.
So Donald Trump speaking this week, their Independence Day celebration. But Martin, there's a few hiccups in his logic, really. One is that what the United States is doing around the world doesn't really tally up with this whole idea of divine equality and everyone having the same rights, certainly when it comes to people's ability to survive and thrive in the United States anymore.
Well, I mean, history is always going to be a contested thing. He's talking about freedom in 1776. A third of the population didn't support the revolutionaries. They were very badly treated. A lot of them were killed. Many of them fled to Canada. But the revolutionaries won. That's what revolutionaries are about. Revolutions are about, you know, people fight, people die, some people lose. But, of course, no slaves got any votes and no women got any votes. And of course, ultimately, there was a civil war, the biggest war in history up to that point, apart from the Taiping Rebellion in China, which was happening simultaneously. Hundreds of thousands of people died to change the Constitution because it didn't recognize black people as equal. So the idea that there's just one uncontested history, don't forget, he's actually making this speech in the Black Hills of Dakota, where the Battle of the Little Bighorn was fought and Wounded Knee took place. So
what's the significance of those events then?
Well, the United States wasn't based on equality for the Oglala Sioux, was it? And it wasn't based on equality for Native Americans, was it? And of course, when he says they're taking our history from us, Trump, who's the son of a German immigrant, so his bloodline doesn't run back to that era in US history. He's white, and therefore he feels as if he is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but he isn't an Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Trump is a German name. And of course, what he's doing there is saying they're taking your history away from you. What's happening is people are critically critiquing their history. There isn't just a history of everything was sorted out in 1776 and it was wonderful and we created a free society and then it's just gone downhill from
there.
Well,
yes, 1776 is interesting in another way, isn't it? As the beginning of this organisation called the Illuminati, which a lot of people poo-poo nowadays, and you know, who knows whether it exists still or not, but it certainly existed in 1776. And what it was really the capstone of lots of different Masonic organisations across Europe. The Wilhelmsbad Conference set it up, and it was really the sort of ultimate secret society that was put together in those days. I always remember the Queen was visiting George W. Bush when he was president, and there was this kind of, they mentioned 1776, and then there was this little wink that Bush did on the camera to the Queen, and she gave him the dirtiest look I've ever seen. If looks could kill, don't do that on camera. Certainly she wasn't happy about that. But, Martin, there's another side to all of this, and that is, of course, what the US is doing in the world today. It just turns out that as he's talking about how great America is, the United Nations is saying the total opposite. Agnes Callamard is the UN's special rapporteur on extrajudicial executions, and she's saying now that the first time ever that there's been an extrajudicial execution of someone who's not involved in an open conflict and not a terrorist. That's pretty scary, isn't it?
Well, I think we're referring here to the Soleimani assassination at the beginning of the year. clearly there is no legal basis for doing something like that.
Well, it takes the UN a long time to get moving. This is 6 months later, but here's Agnes Callamard now from the United Nations.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur has slammed the United States for the targeted killing of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani.
Until January of this year, drones had been used for the purpose of targeting representatives of armed groups that had been deemed a threat by a number of governments, particularly under the concept of terrorism. On January 3rd, 2020, the world moved into a very different space. On that day, the United States used unarmed drones to target and kill Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, as well as a number of his companions, including largely Iraqi representatives. That is a significant and troubling new development. It is the
first known... Kellerman warned that the assassination has created a dangerous precedent. She noted Washington invoked self-defense as a justification for the attack, which targeted a government official outside a declared armed conflict. She noted that many UN member states remained silent over the incident for various reasons, such as fear or diplomatic considerations. The UN expert called on the international community to take action on multiplication, proliferation, export, and use of drones for targeted killing.
So that's a clip from Press TV from earlier this week, but many people won't have heard the analysis, Martin, because Press TV is banned in Britain. That's the Iranian English language state broadcaster.
Yeah, I mean, if COVID hadn't come along, what we'd have been talking about is the collapse of the banking system and the potential for a Middle East war. Now, because we've such a lot, COVID's taking up all the oxygen in the room, we're failing to notice that we're as close to war now as we've ever been. And the potential for something to...
I mean, I noticed Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister this week too, Martin, saying that actually we are now stepping very close to the possibility of a nuclear war for the first time. They're flagging this up.
Not the first time, but we're close.
Yeah, so they're flagging this up. Very important words from Lavrov as well. So there's this military agenda, which is almost like hidden by the smokescreen of the virus.
It is, and of course, if the virus is a bioweapon, then the war's already started, hasn't it? And, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's coincidence. But it's a very strange coincidence. And as I say, the Israeli Defense Forces were warned in September that there was going to be something happening in November in China. How did they know? Now, the point is that we're right at the edge here now. We mentioned Lebanon earlier. The Lebanese economy is in free fall because the US are destabilizing the Lebanese economy to keep the Israelis happy, basically. And the Israelis are in a position where they're looking to see who may or may not win the election in November in the US. And they may be pushed. There's been attacks on Iran this week, bomb attacks on their nuclear facilities, which the Israelis haven't claimed, but the Iranians are suggesting that may well be them. Now, in other words, the Iranians are being provoked and provoked and provoked. They don't want a war, nor do the Russians, nor do the Chinese. But I'm quite sure that all three of them are preparing in all seriousness to fight, as they are in Nicaragua.
Okay, let's get back to the Russians for a second. And Lavrov has urged Russia and the US to adopt a joint declaration on avoiding nuclear war. Moscow submitted the proposals on the entire range of strategic stability issues, but has not so far received any response from the United States, says Russia's top diplomat.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, at various times, Trump has tried to kind of negotiate with the Russians. But of course, this stupid story came out from the deep state in the US about how the Russians were paying the Taliban to kill US soldiers. And on the basis of that, Trump has rescinded the decision to remove
Martin, I don't know if you think it's realistic, but Lavrov has said the presidents of Russia and the United States should jointly declare that the use of nuclear weapons is unacceptable. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said.
But you've got to remember that NATO's strategic doctrine is that we won't say we won't use them first. most people are under the impression that the West's strategic doctrine is we just keep nuclear weapons in case. That's not the case. It's never been the case. And in actual fact, the US has threatened to use nuclear weapons a number of times on non-nuclear targets. So, for example, Truman had to take MacArthur's Field Marshal's baton off him in the 1950s because he was about to nuke China. And Trump said, no, don't, not Trump, I mean Truman said, don't do that. You're not doing that. You're sacked. And that's how close we came. We came very close in 1962. We came very close in 1983. We know now that we nearly got incinerated in 1993 at the height of the cruise missile crisis in Western Europe. And most people are blissfully unaware of all of this. Meanwhile, of course, you've got India and China.
Well,
India,
yeah, China, I mean, China
and
certainly.
Start facing off, all of whom have got nuclear weapons. And, you know, if you read any history, you drew the conclusion that at some point these are going to be used, aren't they?
China we'll talk about now, because in Hong Kong, the chief executive, Carrie Lam, has been saying that national security law is constitutional. She's making that point. But the thing is, it may be legal, but that doesn't mean to say that there's not going to be one hell of a hoo-ha all over Hong Kong because of it, does it?
No, it doesn't. And, of course, what people are saying, that the one system, that two systems, one country.
One country, it's one country, two systems.
One
it's
country, two systems.
That doesn't exist.
No, the two systems, Tony, are supposed to be the economic systems. So Hong Kong is guaranteed.
Well, that's not what it says in the treaty,
economy.
Martin. It's not
what
no,
it says. No, it doesn't say anything about democracy.
There's supposed to be a... Just let me point this out as a fact, right, is that there's supposed to be a transition between the old British system and the Chinese system over 50 years.
Yes.
That's now all basically gone.
No, but the transition is between capitalism and socialism. The Hong Kong system never had elected leadership in Hong Kong. The system was run by big business.
Well, you seem to be saying that it's okay for China to just, impose their law straight away.
I'm just pointing out that there has never been a functioning democracy in Hong Kong. There isn't one today, and there wasn't one before China took over or before the handover.
Well, democracy is only one part of freedom, isn't it?
Well, it is.
The
main part
of
freedom in Hong Kong, as far as the Chinese government is concerned, is the freedom of business. They're not subject to the same business regulations are as in mainland China. But of course,
let's have a listen now to Carrie Lam and what she had to say this week about the national security law.
The Hong Kong SAR government will vigorously implement this law, and I forewarn those radicals not to attempt to violate this law or crossing the red line, because the consequences of breaching this law are very serious.
So if you so much as discuss the idea that President Xi is wrong about something, or if you say we should be independent of China, that's it. You're banged up. You're in jail.
Yeah, and if the same is true on the other side of the line in China itself, isn't it? So Hong Kong is in line.
I mean,
with what
do you think China can tough this out? Because obviously there is quite a lot of disquiet within mainland China too.
Well, yes, but it's largely the idea that the mainland Chinese support protests in Hong Kong, I think, is rather exaggerated. They're relatively privileged.
I mean,
what do you think?
Are we going to see any more protests in Hong Kong now?
We probably are. I think what the government in Beijing would be wise to do is not to overreact to people protesting. People exercising their right to free speech are no threat to the state. There's no reason to persecute them.
We're going to go back to the Middle East now and look at Lebanon. And there was a program on the World Service again. But looking at the quite scary situation we're now at in Lebanon, where 90% of Lebanon's hospitals could be closed within 2 weeks. So let's have a listen to that now. It's a program extract from a program called The Real Story with Ritula Shah.
Henri Chaul is the managing partner and founder of the financial advisory company Levantine Partners, and he was a negotiator on behalf of the Lebanese government with the IMF until he resigned 2 weeks ago. Henri Chaul, Lebanon is facing poverty and suffering. Freddie Baz has begun to tell us about some of the things that lie behind that, and we'll definitely be talking about those during the course of this programme. But is there a personal story, an image, that has really hit home for you that illustrates the scale of the crisis?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me. Let me give you a couple of statistics, and then I'll give you an example. So 50% of the Lebanese population is below the poverty line, and half of those, i.e. 25% of the people of Lebanon, are below the extreme poverty line. That's the type of statistic that is give you a sticker shock. As an example, I was sitting in a nice neighborhood of Beirut about a week ago or 10 days ago with a friend having a coffee in the morning, and here comes a middle-aged woman, clearly from a middle class, well-dressed, and she had a piece of paper on it, which was written on it, "I'm hungry," in French. And she approaches the table, would put the piece of paper on the table and stand back for a meter and wait for people to hand money. So this is unfortunately where we're starting to see that poverty is hitting all kinds of classes, is hitting all kinds of neighborhoods. The lack of accountability and the lack of transparency, I would say, is the story of Lebanon. It's the story of a failed state.
Who would have to relinquish sort of power and I imagine money if you were to move on from that?
Well, I mean, you have the big six, right, that run the country. We all know who they are. You know, I mean, we can go and name them. These are the six political leaders that run the country. They all have to relinquish power if we want to change the system. If we want to change the system, the financial sphere and the public sphere should not be overlapping. Today, the reason we are where we are is because we have a system that really doesn't care about its people. And it shows during those negotiations, as we were going through them, it was not clear to them that the reforms that were being asked by the international community, by the international organization, by the financial experts all over the place, were going to be that serious. And when they realized that actually those reforms that they have to do are really deep-rooted, they all ganged up together, the central bank, the banks, and the politicians, in order to boycott and to hijack the whole process. And today, I mean, look, at the last 2 weeks, since I've resigned 3 weeks ago, but over the last 3 weeks, there has been what? Maybe three, four meetings with the IMF at the heart of an imploding economic and financial and social crisis. Three meetings. I mean, this is not serious. That's the reason why.
So you're saying there's not no sense of urgency, in a sense, in the midst of the crisis?
Not at all.
Just wanted to really bring another illustration to the table. You mentioned the lack of perhaps social net. A clear perhaps indicator of this is the health system. Obviously, this crisis has come in the midst of the coronavirus outbreak. The health system in Lebanon is on the verge of essentially shutting down from a lack of funds. Let's just hear from Dr. Mustafa Alouche. He's a physician and he's actually a former MP too, from Saad Hariri's Future Movement, which is a Sunni Muslim grouping. He's based in Tripoli.
Now we are really in a real danger of closing a good number of private hospitals. The 90% of our medical management in Lebanon is based on private hospitals. And the vast majority of them are not able to pay for the medical supplies and for the regular expenses. This is why now Private Hospital Coalition in Lebanon have decided to stop accepting regular cases, and we're only accepting emergency life-saving cases. But if things do not change, then probably many of these hospitals will close, in addition to the regular cases, to the emergency cases. The hospital coalitions have given the government 2 weeks ultimatum, telling them that if nothing changes over the next 2 weeks, if we don't get enough money, if we don't subsidize the medical supply that we have to get by foreign currency, then we will close completely, except for cases of renal dialysis and chemotherapy for cancer. This is why, at least for the time being, we're seeing a disaster coming very fast.
We are talking about 2 weeks ultimatum for hospitals. We are talking about people, you know, starving in the streets. Ritola, we need an urgent external financial assistance. We need also to do some political concessions in order to be able, beyond the IMF, to get financial assistance from the countries which have traditionally, you know, helped Lebanon.
So that was an extract from the BBC World Service programme, The Real Story, with Ritzel Shah about Lebanon, Martin, is one thing, I mean, you know, an extra bit of information came out in that programme was that much of the national debt was transferred a few years ago from the local currency into dollars, and it's dollars they desperately, desperately need, and it's dollars that they just can't get any more of.
Yeah, well, I mean, Lebanon has always been a fragile setup, because don't forget there was a savage civil war there in the 1970s in which the Israelis intervened promiscuously, invading all the way up to Beirut in 1982, and the state itself was set up by the French. It was carved out of Syria by the French when Syria got independence from France after uprisings and so on. So you've got a very convoluted political system, which basically means that all the different sectarian groups are represented.
But the thing is, the whole country surely can't function if they haven't got any money. I mean, we're also in the situation, as you heard there, where almost all the healthcare is privatised. So it's these privatised companies that can't get money to pay staff or get equipment. So they're just saying, we're going to have to throw the towel in. Obviously, that isn't a government decision. That's a business decision.
Well, what's going on here is that the US has passed the CSAR Act, which basically puts super sanctions on Syria. And they don't like the government of Lebanon because it's got Hezbollah in it. So what this is all basically pressure on Lebanon for them to kick the Hezbollah out of the government, which is what the Israelis want, and to keep sanctions on Syria. So and of course, lots of people in Syria are dependent on bank accounts in Lebanon. So they're being totally affected by this. And it's the run up, potentially, to a war. That's what we're talking about here. Hezbollah aren't leaving the government, and the Iranians have said that they're going to help in Syria by providing aid to Syria to make up for the sanctions, that the extra sanctions, because of course Syria is under sanctions.
There is a similar sort of situation going on in Iran too, because they're finding it impossible to get dollars, Western currency, the same as the Lebanese are. And it was a very clever trick, wasn't it, both from the IMF years ago, to say, oh, well, the Lebanese pound, you don't want to have your debt in Lebanese pounds. Convert it all into dollars and everything will be nice and easy. Now, the chickens have come home to roost.
Yeah, that's because the central bank in Lebanon is run by the US. And, they're basically forcing these policies. It's Israeli Zionist policy and US policy to destroy Iran, destroy Syria and Lebanon as well, because they're not happy with the result of the civil war, which gave Hezbollah a say in the government of Lebanon. So it's all linked. All of these things are linked.
Let's have a look now at we're going to go and look at the Phoenicians, because they came from Lebanon and they did a trip, it looks like, or did several trips or many trips or thousands of trips across the Atlantic, potentially. Mm-hmm. But we're going to look at this chap called Philip Beale, who's done a trip the end of last year in a Phoenician reconstructed boat. But before that, let's have a little listen to an extract. From, I think it's from quite a long time, maybe 2014 edition of In Our Time with Melvin Bragg, where they look at who the Phoenicians were. They were around 800 BC and a bit before and a bit after, but they were the seafaring people. And I sort of feel an affinity with them partly because, the Mediterranean there's a lot of trade going on there. Thousands of years ago, and of course the Brits were very much a trading nation, a maritime nation. So let's have a listen now to Dr. Mark Woolmer speaking on the BBC In Our Time programme about the Phoenicians.
The Phoenicians were famous for their ability to craft the finest vessels. One of the interesting things that all of the ancient sources agree on is the speed of Phoenician vessels. They were fast. And this is because of one of the innovations that Phoenician shipwrights made, which was the cutwater.
Cutwater?
A cutwater, which is essentially a conical projection at the front of a vessel, and it cuts through the water ahead of the front of the ship, thus reducing drag on the hull and making the ship pass much quicker and much more easily across the surface of the ocean. They had sails and they had oars. So if you found yourself in the middle of the Mediterranean and the wind dropped and you're stuck, you could row. But sails were the main form of propulsion. They would use oars to row into shore and into harbour. But they would use sails on the open sea.
Do we know how they got so far ahead of their competitors? After all, the Mediterranean is ringed by cities and towns on the sea.
Well, they had no option in one sense, because of the geography and topography of Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia. On one side is the Mediterranean, on the other side is impenetrable mountains. There's very little farmland, there's very little agricultural land. So the one thing that they have an abundance of is timber. So they recognise that they can use the timber to manufacture boats and then harvest the benefits of the Mediterranean. So from a very early age, sort of even 1300 BC, we find depictions of Phoenician vessels. They're using hockey stick-like oars, they have masts, they even seem to have small sails. So they become a maritime nation from a very early date.
So that was to Mark Woolmer from Durham University talking about the Phoenicians. Martin, the idea that somebody could have maybe made it to the Americas isn't so impossible, is it? Because we know that these maritime people were almost like the intelligence services of the ancient civilizations, because they went all around the world. They were finding stuff out, and they realized that the information they found out here, there, and everywhere had an enormous value. And they wouldn't just dish it out willy nilly. They would maybe even make up cover stories of various sorts to try and explain things.
Well, I have to say I don't find it at all convincing that they did cross the Atlantic. The Vikings certainly did cross the Atlantic. They went across the top.
Okay, but you see, there was a very strong connection between the Phoenicians and the Vikings, because their alphabet was quite like the Viking runes. So, maybe we should have a discussion with you when we've heard from Philip Beale, because he's a former Royal Navy officer who went out and made his fortune in order to try and build one of these, and he did build it, a Phoenician boat, in order to test to see whether these Phoenicians, how easy it would be to cross the Atlantic in one of them. So let's have a listen to the interview I did earlier this week now with Philip Beale.
My name is Philip Beale. I've got a background in adventure, culture, ancient histories. I did my first sort of Contiki-type expedition looking at how Asian influence got to Africa, Madagascar, and West Africa.
How do you have a background in adventure? I mean, surely you need a lot of money to finance something like this.
Well, I started my sort of interest in this at university a long time ago now, and it took me 20 years to, either save up enough money or build up the courage to do my first real adventure, which I did in 2003, which was the Borobudur ship expedition that crossed the Indian Ocean. So I waited, or it took me 20 years of graft and work to be able to do it. And then once I had done that, out of that came the idea of, having looked at how Africa was influenced by some of the Asian cultures, to look at, well, who were the first people to trade with Africa and circumnavigate it? And that's when I decided to build the Phoenician ship.
You've also got a connection, haven't you, with the Royal Navy and with the City of London?
Correct, yes. So I joined the Royal Navy in 1983. I had this vision that the Navy would, be at my disposal and I could do as much adventure and travel as I wanted. And, of course, that was a bit pretty badly misplaced. I was reminded fairly quickly that, the Navy had its ships to sail and to look after. And so I took the decision that if I really wanted to do what I've been doing now, is that I needed to, get out of the Navy, earn some money. And, I ended up in London working. And as I say, I worked there for like 15 years or so before I was in the right position to be able to do my first adventure.
Can I just ask you something about the Navy, though? Because this is obviously in your blood, the sea. What sort of stuff were you doing, without going into too much detail? Did you get around the world quite a bit with the Navy?
No, I went in after university as a junior officer, but I specialised in seamanship. So navigation was part of it. I sailed on two ships, HMS Cardiff and HMS Shetland. And, I was clearly comfortable at sea. And it was a great, opportunity. But I knew that I wanted to do more of the sort of Thor Heyerdahl Contiki kinds of things. And that was only reserved for people that were probably, lieutenant commander and above, and that wasn't me.
It's worth mentioning the whole Contiki expedition, because that inspired, your generation and my generation remember seeing this, I think it was in the early 70s on television, which was, I believe it was an Egyptian vessel which was reconstructed, and then there was an attempt to sail it to America. Am I right about that?
Yes, so the first voyage that Thor Heyerdahl did was the Contiki, looking at whether the Pacific had been colonized from South America. And that was immensely influential, and the book, inspired me as a teenager. But then later in the 1970s, much, two or three decades after he'd done the Contiki expedition, he did the Ra voyage in a papyrus boat, which was sort of built and launched from Morocco, and he sailed that across the Atlantic. The first one sank, and the second one just about made it. Interestingly, I think the idea was inspiring. It was a great idea. Realistically, though, I think, we should credit the Egyptians with a lot more intelligence. They were already building wooden boats, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and they would have known that a papyrus boat would sink.
Is it made of rushes or something? That sounds to me as if you might just about cross a river in it, but not the Atlantic.
Exactly, that's right. It was made of these, reeds, if you like, or papyrus reeds, and would just about last a few weeks until it sank. And of course, you'd get no real sort of navigation with it, but we know from the Cheops boat in the Egyptian pyramids that the Egyptians were building wooden boats at that time. And if they had any sense, they would have actually used a wooden boat. And I think that's where the Phoenicians come in, because history records the Phoenicians were the sailors who were requested by Egyptian pharaohs to do their expeditions. And if anybody was going to sail across the Atlantic from the Mediterranean, it would have been the Phoenicians.
So what was the relationship between the Egyptian Empire and those Phoenicians then?
Yes, so you get, for example, Pharaoh Necho, around 600 BC. He was one of the most expansionist-minded pharaohs. He built the first Suez Canal, and although it was never completed, but he asked the Phoenician mariners to make the first circumnavigation of Africa, and that's been recorded by Herodotus. And the relationship was one of an alliance, really, between the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. And so the Phoenicians got their timbers, like the Lebanese cedar, for example, and they worked very closely together. And a lot of Phoenician artisans, both metal workers, stone workers, worked for the Egyptians. And of course, King Solomon's temple was built by the Phoenicians. So yeah, there was a lot of interaction in the Nile Delta and in that region between the Phoenicians and the Egyptians.
Sounds to me like the Egyptians had the power, but the Phoenicians were the sort of skilled gophers who could get stuff done. Obviously they're quite handy people to have around. What period in history are we talking about? Because some people say that the Phoenician civilization really started as far back as about 1500 BC, when we know they were certainly very active around sort of 600 BC. But do you know how far they went back?
Yes. I mean, a lot of chronicles sort of date it from about 1200 BC. But some of the academics are now saying, actually, if you look at the Canaanites, who were the predecessors to the Phoenicians, nothing really changed between the Canaanites and the Phoenicians. It was the same people, the same civilization, the same cultures, and therefore you could extend the Phoenician history back at least to, say, 2000 BC. So, you know, we're talking about a very ancient civilization that lasted pretty much, you know, two millennia.
Also, think about it, you know, these people would have kept their secrets. I mean, for example, how to design and build a ship, whereabouts to sail that ship to get what you wanted. They would keep that pretty close to their chest. One of the things I know that the Phoenicians did develop was the first phonetic alphabet, which is a pretty amazing thing to invent. And the idea was, before that, all we had was kind of symbols like hieroglyphics and things like that. And they realized, well, actually, it's a lot easier if we just use a language which is about the sounds that we're making when we speak. It makes it a lot easier to write a written language down, because you've got to have so many symbols for so many different things. And the interesting thing I found was just researching this earlier is that other parts of the world seem to pick up the similar system to the Phoenicians, both in alphabet, language, and also in the way they measured things. So that does, I mean, it does suggest that they were using these ships to go further afield than just the Mediterranean.
Yes, I mean, certainly, you know, our modern day alphabet can be traced to the Phoenicians, and possibly the numbering system, although that may have come more from sort of Arabic quarters. But certainly the Phoenician alphabet is the basis of our modern alphabet that was, you know, developed further by the Greeks. But the basis of the modern alphabet spread, and there are clues to the Phoenician alphabet, you know, throughout the Mediterranean and even into parts of West Africa, that the Phoenicians brought the alphabet and their symbols of the alphabet, if you like, with them.
You're interested in testing this hypothesis of the possibility that one of their rather nice ships could have made it across the Atlantic. Is there any evidence that of any kind of signs of a Phoenician style influence in the Americas?
Well, it partly depends on sort of who you ask. And I think at this stage, I would say there's no real absolute proof, but there are some very strong, interesting sort of theories. And I would say the main one is probably the fact that the Cherokee Indians, for example, have what we'd call a Phoenician or a Middle Eastern gene in their DNA. So, and this gene has been identified as arriving possibly a couple of thousand years ago. It's not a modern Middle Eastern gene. So it's come from some people who have, if you like, married into the native, or some of the native Indians on the eastern seaboard of America. And, you know, no one has got a realistic or put forward a plausible explanation other than that this may have been because the Phoenicians or other sailors came across the Atlantic and you know, mixed with the local indigenous people. So that's probably the main one. But there are also botanical pieces of evidence that would imply that there may well have been, you know, transatlantic voyages in ancient times.
So I know that there's been some evidence found in Egyptian tombs that points to potentially to trade with the Americas.
Yes, that's right. So there's evidence from some of the Egyptian mummies that have been excavated that they have found traces of nicotine and cocaine. And, you know, these substances were clearly only found in the New World in ancient times, or, you know, before the arrival of the European adventurers and explorers. So, you know, there has to be an explanation for this. And it'll be interesting as more tombs are opened and more examples are found as to whether we get even more information from this. But that's certainly one of, you know, the botanical pieces of evidence, and quite a lot of the sort of scientific community, if you like, are sort of fairly silent about, you know, how this nicotine or cocaine could have ended up in Egyptian mummies.
Well, I mean, what we're told is Christopher Columbus discovered the Caribbean and South America, even though, of course, there were people already there who'd already discovered it. And John Cabot sailing from Bristol in 1497, financed by the Bardi Bank in Milan, I think, was it? Anyway, in Italy somewhere, discovered Newfoundland and discovered North America. So this is the official, this is what historians will tell you and I. I mean, have you encountered resistance to your theory?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I mean, you know, we had a great reception when we did our voyage from across the Atlantic from September last year, and we arrived via way of the Dominican Republic, and we arrived in Fort Lauderdale in early February this year. But I was invited to do a talk to the Miami Yacht Club, and I mentioned about the parallels with Columbus. His first voyage, I think, took 35 days. We took 39 days to reach the Caribbean. And I put in my talk about how terrible Columbus had been in really being the grandfather, if you like, of the European slave trade. He was the first person to export 500 slaves back from the Caribbean to Spain. And he treated the indigenous people incredibly cruelly. I mean, I won't bore you with the details, but it was, you know, it was terrible. And quite a few members of the yacht club left my talk before I even really started. And the next day we were asked to leave, you know, we were at anchor just off the yacht club, but we were asked to leave because we'd upset some of the members. So, yeah, it's a very controversial issue in America, as you've probably seen from the recent news.
Bristol too. We've recently toppled the, you know, in 2020, the statue of Edward Colston, the slave trader, although people have also pointed the finger at John Cabot too, saying that, you know, although he didn't really get involved very much himself, he really started, he did a sort of reconnaissance for the genocide that was to come later. But look, you've hinted there at your trip, but this was no normal trip across the Atlantic, was it? You managed to actually get the first replica Venetian boat built. I mean, how on earth do you go about, first of all, finding out, getting the plans to build a boat that hasn't been built for thousands of years?
Again, it took a few years to do it. It took us about, or took myself and my team about 3 years to do the research. And it was quite painstaking. But eventually, we identified a wreck that was found off of Marseille called the Jules Verne 7 wreck, which is of Phoenician or Aegean origin, dated to 600 BC, which is exactly when we believe the Phoenicians would have made this kind of voyage. And there was enough detail in the planks and the keel of this wreck that Aix-en-Provence University had excavated to give us the information to build a replica. And, you know, obviously there's more evidence that goes into this because, you know, on Greek vases, for example, there are images of sails of the Phoenician ships and what the rudders look like and that, which is obviously not available in the wreck. But the wreck gave us the plan of the hull, which was the key ingredient. So we believe we've got, you know, the most representative Phoenician ship that's, you know, done ocean, you know, crossings and the like.
So how did you get it built?
Well, what I did, I wanted to build it in one of the great sort of ancient Phoenician ports. So I went down the Lebanese coast, which is really the home of the Phoenicians, And unfortunately, there wasn't really any boat builders who were capable of building it in the ancient way, and certainly not in the sort of time scale that I had in mind. So I then went up into Syria, which also has Phoenician heritage as well, just north of Beirut. And there's a little Phoenician island called Arwad, just opposite to Tartus and east of Cyprus. And there was a community of wooden boat builders. And luckily I found a guy who had been at, as it happened, Southampton University, and he was able to translate for me. And we managed to do a deal with these wooden boat builders to build the Phoenician ship. And once they understood exactly what the project involved, because they weren't used to building it in an ancient way, they built their boats in a fairly modern way, you know, they actually built this replica ship within about 9 months. We started in sort of late 2007, and by August 2008, the boat was ready to launch.
You're obviously in a seagoing man, a ship's captain. What can you just describe the boat for us, the ship for us?
Visually, it looks a little bit like a Viking ship, with a single square sail, but it's much more curvaceous, if you like, than a Viking ship. So it's 20 meters long, but it's nearly the beam is nearly 6 meters wide. So it's quite a heavy looking sort of boat. It's got a freeboard of about a meter and a half. So it, from a sort of safety point of view, it's relatively safe and stable, but it's a little bit like a big sort of bathtub. But it's a single masted vessel, but at the stern, all of these ancient boats, whether they're Egyptians, Greeks or Phoenician, had two quarter rudders, and you need at least two men or women to, you know, actually manage the quarter rudders and steer her. But essentially, yeah, single masted square rig. And she's really just a downwind sailor. You can't sail into the wind particularly. So she was effectively would have been a seasonal vessel, really, but a trading vessel. I mean, the Phoenicians did have warships as well, which are thinner and longer with, you know, 20, 50 oarsmen to them. But what we're talking here is about a galley that would have traded metals, ceramics, olive oil, wine, the things that the Phoenicians traded in.
Okay, and what's below decks? It's obviously, you know, if you're going to go across the Atlantic, you're going to be spending quite a lot of time down there. You need to have some facilities.
Yeah, we actually just, below decks, just hung some hammocks across on this voyage, and some of the crew slept on the floor. Other crew members, you know, used the hammocks. We did actually have at one point a rat on board, and as soon as everyone knew there was a rat on board, then they got off the deck and started sleeping in the hammock. So that was quite amusing until we managed to catch the rat and drown it. But life on board was relatively challenging.
Okay, so you went round, circumnavigated Africa first before you decided to set off across the Atlantic. What did you learn doing that?
Yeah, the circumnavigation of Africa was a long trip. It took us 2 years and 2 months to circumnavigate Africa because we stopped as we went along. We managed to dodge, you know, the Somali pirates because we did it in sort of 2009, 2010 at the height of the Somali pirates issue. But gradually, as we got to learn how to sail the ship, the process became, you know, easier and easier. And we were able to show that, you know, a Phoenician ship, if you knew what you were doing, you know, you could sail around the Cape of Good Hope in fairly treacherous conditions. I mean, we had 30 to 40 knot winds as we went around the Cape, and we managed to do it reasonably, you know, without incident. So, and that it was possible that these vessels could, you know, sail around Africa. And that's what inspired us to think, well, actually, if they could have done that, then why couldn't they have gone, you know, to the Americas, which has been a big question about the Phoenician civilization, because When you read about some of the accounts, I mean, Strabo, the you know, the Greek historian, he talks about the Phoenicians having 300 settlements down the eastern Atlantic coast, sort of from, you know, Iberia down to Morocco, down to West Africa. So if they had 300 settlements there for trade, then the chances that they went out into the Atlantic and crossed it seemed to be pretty good, for, you know, as far as I can see.
Yes, and you've also got a few islands out there, haven't you, up and down the Atlantic, that they may stop off at halfway.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, Tenerife and the these islands, you know, Madeira, perhaps not so much the Azores, but certainly places like Tenerife, they have found evidence, again, of Phoenician writing influencing the local peoples, the indigenous people there. So, yeah, definitely. That would have helped them get partway across the Atlantic, for sure.
Now, another connection between Egypt and that part of the world and the particularly South America is the pyramids. I mean, a lot of people may say, well, hang on a minute, this is an interest. It may just be that this is what people want to build and that there's no connection. But some have also said that there was a similar sort of civilization on both sides. Is there any evidence, do you think, that there was some kind of similar influence on the building of, the, say, for example, the Mayan pyramids in South America and the Egyptians?
I think it's probably a little bit speculative whether there was actually some correlation. But, I mean, for many years in Mexico, it was taught, you know, as a fact that the Phoenicians came to Mexico, for example. And there's a book that was written about Haiti, you know, over 100 years ago, saying that the Phoenicians came to Haiti, which in those days was the whole island, Dominican Republic and modern day Haiti, and that the peoples there were of Phoenician stock, and they then went onto the mainland. So, you know, it's not beyond possibility that there are some connections, and certainly a lot of people think there are those connections, you know, that they are, you know, realistic. But I think it's probably not, you know, proven at this stage.
Now, so we had thought, you're talking about the Mexicans there being taught one thing. We're taught in Britain that Christopher Columbus and John Cabot were the first over there. There's actually other contenders, aren't there, that like the Vikings you mentioned, and I think certain fishing people as well are supposed to have managed to make it across. And I think, you know, your main object of your trip is to see whether it was possible. I mean, it's a difficult question to answer maybe, but did you find it quite easy sailing over there? Did you find it, you know, challenging? I mean, I suppose, you know, the other thing is if there are storms around, that's obviously going to make things rather awkward. I mean, what was your sense for whether it was a difficult trip, having, you know, actually sailed these ships quite a bit around Africa, making it over to the Caribbean or not?
I think actually, yeah, it was relatively straightforward to do the crossing, to be honest. You know, whilst one would like to sort of say, oh, it was really difficult and hard and stuff, the prevailing winds and currents come straight off of the Moroccan coast and take you to the Caribbean. So, and with a downwind rig, square rig like the ancients would have had, you know, there would be no problem. And the Gulf Stream could have taken them back slightly further north via the Azores across, you know, the Atlantic the other way. So you've got these convectional currents and winds that lead to this kind of journey. And you're absolutely right. There are at least half a dozen accounts of other voyages that may have reached the Americas, but certainly before Columbus and Cabo did. There are stories in the 10th century of Arabic voyages going from Spain across. There is a Mali king in the 13th century, who launched two very big expeditions across the Atlantic, one of them with, you know, numerous ships, which one voyage came back and one didn't come back. But there's definitely, when you get into the detail of it, there are many more recordings of voyages which have never, if you like, had the publicity that they, you know, probably deserve.
The Legends of Atlantis. I mean, this is something which most people have heard of. Most people think, oh, that's a load of nonsense. But it may be that the seafarers that have been over there and come back that were told not to say anything, you know, might even talk about another place they visited and probably been poo-pooed as conspiracy theorists in medieval times. But, I mean, do you think that there's potentially some sort of link to the Legend of Atlantis here?
I don't actually think so myself, based on sort of what I've read, in the sense that the depths in the Atlantic, it's not really credible. But the couple of things I would say, one is that, you know, there's certainly stories which appear to be true, that the Carthaginians, who were really the sort of, you know, the Phoenicians in the Western Mediterranean, that they blockaded the Straits of Gibraltar to stop some of the Greeks and other traders getting access to, you know, the metals and fish supplies in the Atlantic. So, and they were keen to keep secret the riches that were in the Atlantic. But the other thing is too, which comes back perhaps more to the Atlantis story a little bit, is that in the Azores, they have, or, you know, a couple hundred years ago, they found some Carthaginian coins, and this was recorded at the time. And these coins, you know, if that find is true, and as I say, there was a Swedish inquest into this discovery in the 1960s, which it concluded it was genuine. If that's true, because the ancient ships could have only sailed, if you like, from the west, they would have had to get to the Americas, you know, to come back. Then I think, you know, the idea that the Phoenicians or the Carthaginians could have been sailing out in the Atlantic and being quite comfortable with those voyages, it does start to take on a bit of a different meaning.
Do you think the Phoenicians would have ever made it to Bristol?
Well, we know that the Phoenicians, certainly their trade made it to Bristol, because just a few years ago, I'm talking 3-4 years ago, a Phoenician coin was found on the River Avon after a flood, and the British Museum confirmed that they believed it to be genuine, and it proved that there was a Phoenician trade with the West Country. And, you know, although there's perhaps a debate with some of the people in Cornwall as to whether there was, Phoenician contact, I think the evidence is now growing. And that coin that I mentioned that was found a few years ago definitely shows that Phoenician trade reached Cornwall. And you may have seen, I mean, last year there was an article about a wreck that was found in Israel, in the Mediterranean, but on the Israeli coast. And this wreck had some tin ingots in the wreck. They analyzed the tin, and guess where it came from? It came from Devon and Cornwall. They could identify, you know, signature identified it clearly and scientifically with coming from, you know, South Devon and Cornwall. So, you know, there is no doubt that the Phoenicians were definitely trading with the southwest of England.
Painted with a pretty slick picture of sailing this ancient galley, reconstructed galley, as if it was almost a modern ship without too much trouble. But you've been sailing around the world, to, you know, not the whole way around the world, but you've been sailing all over the place for months in this. You must have had a few moments.
Yes, I mean, for sure. And particularly to start with, we had some very tricky moments in learning how to sail it. You know, at one point in the Red Sea, we nearly sailed it, or I nearly sailed it with my crew, into an oil rig, which was, you know, going to cause a lot of problems. But eventually we got to manage it and then, you know, learn how to manage it. So, and keeping it, off the rocks, keeping it safe, you know, for the last 12 years has been a, you know, quite a job. But yeah, I've spent, you know, during that time for 3.5 years of my life actually on board it and, you know, looking after it. But it's, we've had a few, you know, moments, but touch wood, you know, we've got away with the risks involved.
Where is she now?
She's currently in Fort Lauderdale in the States, which is where we ended the expedition. And we're looking really for a long-term home to retire her, you know, and I'm sort of wondering if we found a place either back here in the UK, where she could be part of a, you know, an attraction and part of a maritime museum or something like that. But, you know, we've also got some interest in the States. There's also a little bit of interest in Beirut that has a new maritime museum. But, we just need to find her a home that could pay off some of the debts that's been incurred in, you know, putting on the expedition and, building the ship originally. If we can't find a home in the States in the next year, then next summer we'll bring her back either to the UK or to the Mediterranean and find a long-term home here, this side of the Atlantic. So I think, yeah, it's possible for sure.
It'd be not lovely to have her sitting next to the Matthew in the harbour in Bristol, so people could sort of scratch their heads and wonder who really did it first. But anyway, Philip Beale, thanks ever so much for joining us. So if you could just finish by telling our listeners whereabouts they can find out more about your trip and maybe see some photographs of the boat.
Yeah, we have a website, which is PhoeniciansBeforeColumbus.com, but also on Facebook. We have a very active page there, which is Facebook/PhoeniciansBeforeColumbus. So there's lots of pictures, lots of the crew. And if you have interest in this project, then please drop me a line. We've had an article on the Americas. We've had some articles in some quite good publications. The Times did a piece on us and the Middle Eastern Eye did. And I'm hoping that by Christmas we'll have a book out, you know, which I've got a working title of Columbus Came Last, The Voyage of the Phoenicia to the Americas. So I'm hoping to get that finished in time for Christmas.
Okay, Philip Beale, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, that's Philip Beale from PhoeniciansBeforeColumbus.com. I wonder if your views have changed at all, Martin. He sort of dropped in there, didn't he, that they found all these coins from Carthaginian coins in the Azores, which can only have meant that the Carthaginians were going backwards and forwards.
Well, I mean, evidence has to be adjudicated for any of these claims, doesn't it? And if you find Carthaginian coins in the Azores, that wouldn't be that surprising for the reasons he's explained. That doesn't mean that they necessarily went on to North America. He mentioned genetic.
I think you may be misunderstood, but the Azores are on the trade winds coming from back. West to east.
Yeah, coming back.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, and obviously it creates a great deal of interest for people to question what they seem to be historical, historical truth.
Is it possible for all these university profs to have got it wrong over the years?
Well, of course it is. I mean, the whole point of genuine investigation is that you're willing to change your views if the facts change. An obvious point to point out was that the very earliest connections by the Europeans with the Americas in the 1500s immediately caused a massive die-off because they weren't exposed to old world pathogens. Now, if anybody had got there earlier, you might wonder whether that would have happened, you know, why
yeah, I mean, that's, I think it's that smallpox you're talking about. Yeah, the same thing exactly.
The smallpox, colds, all sorts of stuff.
And the flu. Most of the
pathogens that developed in the old world developed from old world farming, which involves close interaction with livestock. And that's precisely what they didn't have.
Well, and also it's sort of slum conditions as well, which they didn't have.
Well, no, it's not just that. It's because agriculture developed independently in the Americas, but it was very much plantation agriculture. They didn't really have livestock. And, of course, that means that they didn't get exposed to the pathogens of in the old world. And there's a very interesting book that I read some time ago now about The Great Divide, it's called. And it's about how civilization evolved separately in the Americas from, you know, the Eurasian continent and the very big differences there were in the way that it evolved. One obvious thing that the book points out is that in Latin America, you've got literally hundreds of psychotropic plants, which were clearly very fundamental to the culture. You know, Aztec priests would be dropping mushrooms as they ripped out people's hearts. Whereas, of course, in Eurasia, there was a tradition of using, you know, chemicals or rather plants to change consciousness. But gradually, with the invention of farming and the ubiquity of alcohol, the culture changed so that there was a very big difference between the cultural mindsets on the two sides. And of course, the more we find out about human history, the more fascinating it becomes. And with modern genetic techniques, it really does become possible to say where people did and didn't come from. And of course, one of the most controversial aspects of that is that many Ashkenazi Jews probably aren't Semites. But there you go.
Okay, well, finally, the Viking ships, very much like those Phoenician ships, similar. And anyway, the Danes have just, it's just finished with a bit of news from this week. The Danes have given the nod to the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. And the Danish Energy Agency has green-lighted the use of Russian ships that could speed up execution of the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. The US sanctions have attempted to stop all this, so the US sanctions are still sort of changing and extending themselves as we speak in order to try and stop the pipeline, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think they're bringing Russian ships in to do it. Because Western-based companies will be subject to sanctions. And since the Russians are under sanctions anyway, it doesn't make any difference to them if they complete the pipeline.
I mean, it seems that the Americans have used a very dirty tactic here. In other words, they've waited until the pipeline is almost finished before they pull out their final card in order to try and stop it. So it's 775 miles in length. Nord Stream 2 is running from Russia's Ust-Luga, but is now on hold 160 kilometres off the German coast. So it's getting very, very close to Germany, but the UN sanctions came into force before Christmas, and the Swiss Dutch company had to withdraw its ships, but now apparently the Russians are sailing over to save the day.
Yeah, it's not UN sanctions, it's US sanctions. There's no basis in UN law for them to do this.
No, of course not. No, it's the Americans course, trying to stop
what,
this.
What it's beginning to do is the industrialists in Germany are basically beginning to say, well, you know, we don't really want to be in an alliance with the US. Ultimately, if they're going to carry on bullying us like this, we're going to send, you know, Trump is talking about taking US soldiers out of Germany. And in actual fact, on the left in Germany, people say, well, just take them home. We don't want them. But of course, what Trump's going to do then is he's going to move them into Camp Trump in Poland. And of course, you've got the Polish presidential election coming up on Sunday, which Duda may win. And of course, he's very much pushing for the troops in Germany to be moved into Poland. But of course, from the Russian point of view, It's not really provocative because they can't possibly invade Russia from there. But the Russians have no intention of invading Poland anyway. But what will happen...
And it's Poland and Ukraine have been the most vocal against this pipeline.
Yes, because the reason why the Germans and the Russians have cooperated to build it is because both the Poles and the Ukrainians could hold Germany to ransom. I mean, over politics, unless they can get their stuff, their gas directly from Russia. And, of course, this... basically shows the way in which the world is changing. A multipolar world is gradually emerging from under the 500 years of Western domination, which began with the discovery of the Americas.
Okay, the U.S. sanctions, apparently the U.S. Congress is discussing a new sanctions bill will extend the scope of the already imposed penalties targeting the insurers. Companies working on related pipeline activities such as trenching. The key provision of the newly proposed sanction is to hit entities that provide certification services. So the Americans are trying to do everything to stop this at the very last minute. I mean, how come the US can decide on a pipeline that's being laid right in the Baltic? It's a sea undersea pipeline, isn't it?
Well, because the Americans rule the world. And they want full spectrum dominance. And ultimately, if they keep on this road, they will end NATO and the world will be a very different place.
Anyway, the Danes want the pipeline. The Germans want the pipeline. The Danish decisions make it much easier and cheaper for Russia to complete Nord Stream 2, said Anna Mikulska from Rice University in Texas. Now, the question is, whether the already existing US sanctions would then apply to Gazprom. Oh dear, oh dear. Well, do you think they'll finish the pipeline or not, Martin?
I think they will, yeah. I mean, the Germans will be very, very put out noses out of joint if it's not finished. Don't forget they've invested loads of money in it. And, of course, what the Americans really hate is the idea that Germans...
It's $11 billion, by the way, 10 billion euros.
Yeah, well, what they really hate is the idea that German industry with cheap Russian gas is going to undersell them. And, of course, they want them to buy more expensive gas from the United States so that they can keep their fracking industry going. And you've got to remember that, you know, the American Empire is about to make America great again. It's not to make Germany great again, is it?
Back to the energy business again, isn't it? Anyway, fascinating... way to finish, I think, sort of looking at that pipeline, because, I mean, the amazing thing is, Martin, with all this money that's been invested in it, it wouldn't take much, a little missile and it's bust, isn't it?
Well, no, it's actually been laid under the sea to avoid exactly that.
Surely they can put explosives under the sea and someone could blow it up.
If somebody does then that's an act of war, isn't it? So you've got to expect retaliation.
Like the assassination of Soleimani.
Well, indeed. We're on, you know, the US empire in its death throes is probably more dangerous than it's ever been. And that doesn't really make any difference who wins the election in November. There's going to be a reckoning of enormous proportions. They've been living basically on tick. On the back of the petrodollar system that we discussed earlier, and as that unravels, you're going to see massive, possibly destructive changes.
And this attempt to destroy the Nord Stream pipeline is vicious, because really all it's doing is reacting to the fact that the United States is a has-been empire that can't compete anymore.
Well, it's vicious. I mean, the whole extraterritorial sanctions that the US seems to be insisting on, in other words, the sanctions supposedly have to be agreed by the UN. But if you impose them without UN agreement, they're an act of war in themselves. And, of course, the US is at war with the developing world. It is at war with the Russian leadership. It is at war. It wants to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. They are determined to have full spectrum dominance. And Britain, of course, is going to be caught up in this. There's going to be massive trade wars. We're going to have a trade war in which we are going to be a little cork in the middle of a sea of tsunamis of everybody slapping tariffs on everybody else. which is what happened in the 1930s.
Well, let's just
and we know where that ended.
Let's just hope Britain can feed itself in the meantime. We shall see. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s, listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 with Danny Loch, always worth a listen. Do please join us for our politics show live stream, the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.